The contagion spreads by touch like wildfire. Everything accelerates beyond any imagination. Within seconds, the disease takes over the whole system.
And the bacilli is growing in these petri dishes?
They are now fully matured. They can live in a saline solution indefinitely.
Why the plague, Bacillus, Julian? You, Professor Julian Keeley, awarded the Nobel Prize for Science and Humanity. Why, Julian? You're going to tell me who commissioned you to work on this atrocity. And what's so important to you and to them about the 23rd of this month? Otherwise, I shall have no alternative but to report this whole matter to higher authorities.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not VCFM Politics Show. Still, it's come, it's about 10 months now since we've been allowed to be on FM with mate of the Mayor Marvin Rees, Pat Hart, the BCFM station manager, deciding to remove us from the airwaves. And now, me going through a procedure whereby I'm asking the board to have a look at that decision, and Jerry Cowhick, the chair of the board, won't even acknowledge the letter that I sent back in the middle of December. So, not a very efficient organisation at Bristol Community FM. Don't seem to want to even talk to me now, almost like I'm a persona non grata, even though I had a volunteer agreement and all sorts that I was supposed to on the airways every week. Let's not go on about that now. Let us look at We're Live on the PRSC stream. That is from 5 every Friday. And today it's the 29th of January 2021. We're also on at 11 and 5 on that stream throughout the week. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and Lib Dem councillor on Bristol City Council for Pengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. In the second part, hacking the US elections. No, it's not the Venezuelans or the Russians or even Cambridge Analytica or China, which Biden is known to be particularly friendly with. It's the enemy within. Professor Robert Epstein is a Democrat, but he says his research on Google algorithms indicates a roughly 30 percent point swing to Biden from Trump for anybody foolish enough to research the candidates on the Google search engine. A close look at that story on World Net Daily this week. Plus, a closer look at the oligarchs who hope to take over the world. Well, how will they get on? Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab. Analysis on them by Scottish journalist and Civil Liberties podcaster Natalie Minnis. And as of tonight, you'll be hearing a lot more of my longer interviews, the ones we haven't had time to broadcast on this stream when we're not on during the week. But first, to local politics here in the venerable city of Bristol, which has the ignominious honour of having sent John Cabot over to so-called Discover North America back in 1497, 5 years after Spanish-sponsored Columbus landed in the Caribbean and South America. And also, we look at Desmond Swain on the Richie Allen Show. He's a Tory MP. Can you imagine anything more terrible? Well, Joe Mulhall from Hope Not Hate doesn't believe any of these people, especially not Richie Allen, should even be heard anywhere, because they're so evil. He libels Allen, but not Desmond Swain, knowing that Swain would take him to court and that Richie Allen can't afford to. That the hate not hope, or hope not hate, what do you think? Plus, Roy Pumphrey from Stock Hinkley are on the 3,000 extra jobs going down near Bridgewater, and whether the French-Chinese project will ever be finished. There's my three books, which have been published in the last 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown. The Traitors of Arnhem, about the fate of 3,000 British paratroopers in Arnhem and secret deals between Churchill's private secretary Desmond Morton and Hitler's treasurer Martin Bormann. The Endgame of World War II and the beginning of the Bilderberg conferences. Plus my articles and essays collection, The Siege of Heaven and the post-medieval power history of extracts of various books. That's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. I'll be sending free versions of these out, and I have been, with my weekly emails. But as Google has disappeared my good old Google, my email list, you'll have to email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. If you can't remember that address, obviously email address is a fiendish to remember. You can find it along with all the books and everything else on my show page at thisweek.org.uk. The books are on the Martin Bormann tab of the show site, thisweek.org.uk. Or you can buy and download all those three at Bilderberg.org. And I'm hoping to get some of them actually printed up soon. At the moment, they're just ebooks. But anyway, first it's Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. He's joining me to look at the last month or so in Bristol politics. Tim's been criticised for criticising. Well, I thought that was his job as a councillor. The lack of information coming out of the mayor's office on several issues. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, good evening.
Now, do you want to take us through this? Because we've had over the last 4 years at least, there's been news stories trickling out of the city council about less and less information coming down to our elected councillors, a kind of hoarding of information by the mayor's office. And this is actually stuff you need, don't you, in order to do the job we elect you to do, which is to scrutinise how the 350 million quid or so of our council tax and other taxpayers' money that Marvin Rees and his chums are spending every year.
Well, yes, I mean, it's not uncommon. In fact, I'd say it's now commonplace for the council to make reports confidential. So they often say they're commercially confidential, so nothing can be revealed. The most recent take in this is that the external auditor, as part of preparing the accounts, of course, who works for one of the big four accountancy firms, has come back and criticised the council himself over the secrecy of the council. It was pointed out that the use of confidentiality on reports sometimes means information that is not confidential has been made confidential, and has challenged the council to reconsider how many reports it makes confidential. And it should be said, when it makes these reports confidential, it doesn't just make them confidential to ratepayers, to residents, but to councillors as well. So who really knows what's going on?
And what about this bizarre thing I was reading about in the Bristol Post, where apparently a select group of councillors are allowed on Zoom to watch a council officer quickly flicking through a report so they can read it, but they're not allowed to film it, record it, make notes or have a copy themselves?
Well, that was me. So that's easy for me to answer, because I was one of those select councillors. This was to do with Bristol Energy and an external report done by some consultants, very much into just how unviable Bristol Energy truly was. Again, of course, the report was made super confidential. We were, as the audit committee, we demanded access to the report. And the monitoring officer, backed by the chief executive, and I'm sure influenced potentially by others, decided that the only way we would be allowed to see the report that we needed to see would be via, well, originally we had to go into a room during the middle of a pandemic with an officer watching us. When we objected to that, we were offered to look at it over Zoom with an officer turning it page by page. We were actually allowed to make notes, but we were not allowed to have a copy of the report. I mean, the waste of time, the inefficiency, the danger to good decision making that this makes is unbelievable. And there are systems in place. Other members of the committee, in fact, had the report sent to them simply because they sat on a different committee and there they had different access rights. And for the last year or so, the audit committee has been fighting for the access level it needs, and I've got to say, has met resistance all the way from senior officers. It is an unacceptable situation, and the audit committee has made clear that we are not going to give in on this.
Well, that really is bizarre, because surely it's audit's job to scrutinise this stuff as much, if not more, than any other committees. Martin Summers, you're joining us too. It almost seems as if we've got a big business kind of Shell Oil Exxon culture is creeping its way into City Hall.
Well, as people who have listened to this show for many years will know, I'm not a great fan of having elected mayors at all. And of course, the tendency is for power to be, you know, gathered together in too few hands and for not enough people to know what's going on. And I don't claim to know what's going on here any more than anybody else does. But, you know, in the bad old days of having, political parties running the council on the basis of who got the most votes and that there was a wider spread of people who were involved in a scrutiny of these kind of decisions.
Tim, somebody that was certainly around in those days too, can you just talk, you know, talk us through the sort of different culture that there is now, and now we've got a mayor?
Well, I mean, secrecy obviously is one of the key areas. Far more reports confidential, far less being shared with councillors. Certainly back in the day, we'd have a lot more multi-member groups working cross-party on more difficult issues. The idea being that quite often when you share information, actually, there's only one or two conclusions you can make, and you can bring people with you and include their ideas. That is no longer welcome at Bristol City Council. I mean, we have a mayor who is quite disconnected, I'd say, from the council. I think that's probably always going to be the case. It's a virtually impossible role. But we must remember all executive power is in the hands of one person. It is quite extraordinary, the level of executive power in the hands of a British elected mayor, perhaps compared to those on the continent or in America, because there's more checks and balances in place. Here, what they did was they rushed to adopt a system without fully understanding it and without putting the correct checks and balances in place. The area committees, which used to service people, the neighbourhood partnerships, which had power to decide things locally, have all been scrapped by the mayor. So that has gone. The cross-party cabinet has gone. So we have very centralised power, very limited decision-making, sharing decision-making responsibility. And that does mean, of course, you have less challenge in the system. Part of the way British democracy works is through challenge. You put up an idea, others challenge it. If it's still there standing, it's probably a good idea.
Now, let's run through some of the controversial projects that the mayor has launched upon the city, one of which is this whole Western Harbour development plan. Now, it almost looks to me as if this is something that a few speculators and Business West came up with, and Marvin Rees, the mayor, just kind of came along to him and stuck his stamp at the top of the page.
Well, yes, there's a lot of other questions about that. I know the ward councillor for that area, Mark Wright, has been consistently asking one question to the mayor every month. And that is, please release all of the concepts for Western Harbour. And the mayor refuses to do that. Again, I believe under confidentiality grounds. So I mean, even the local councillor there for Western Harbour is unable to get that information. It is shocking. And what we're also seeing now are large development agreements with developers, sometimes putting the council, we believe, at quite strategic risk. If we remember, the arena got scrapped in favour of a large developer. And part of that development agreement is that the council would underwrite some of that development, including a major office block. If that office block was not occupied, the council would pick up the costs. Now, what we're seeing now is potentially a shift in the way people operate as businesses. With so many people working at home, a lot of businesses are going to realise they'll save a lot of money by not having so many people in the office at the end of this pandemic. I think it's quite likely that we will see less people working in offices and more people working at home,
part-time. There's an obvious point there, Tim, and that is the arena. Obviously, right now, for the last year or so, and possibly another year or more into the future, that arena would be either empty or have only something like one tenth of its capacity. So I suppose we, as council taxpayers, we could say it's rather lucky that we didn't end up footing the bill for that.
Well, the good news is they still would have been building it because Bristol City Council has never delivered a project on time yet from its capital budget. So we wouldn't have got to opening stage when the pandemic hit. The bad news for you is, well, for all of us, is the arena was about trying to centre the city centre. That might seem a really weird idea, but we can all see that traditional shopping is dying. Traditional shopping centres are dying. Sorry about that. What is going to bring people into our city centres? And one of the key things that will do that are leisure experiences. That's what the arena was about, protecting the city centre for the next 20 years. And that we will not have.
Amazing. Okay, so what about these other projects? There's Temple Island 2, which was the site originally slated for the arena, but now it's been taken over by the university. And there's basically, I had a look at the plans, and we did discuss this with George Ferguson a few months ago, the former mayor. It seems to me as if on that island, rather than arena, is going to be put just about as many office buildings and possibly accommodation, but it looks mainly like office buildings for the university as possibly could be crammed onto that space. So if you imagine a little circle with a whole load of Lego bricks piled up as high as they possibly can on that little circle. So that deal itself also was done kind of behind closed doors, wasn't it? This is public land, of course, we're talking about here.
Yeah, with the university campus, which was not quite on the it was on the arena island, but not the arena site. I think that what that did was that also fundamentally undermined the arena, because the idea was the arena was going to also be supportive to some of those businesses next to it. And actually, the university did not need the arena. So that undermined completely that concept. So and you're right. Of course, a lot of the times these things are, of course, done in secret. So we've just got to accept those elements as part of business. But what we do need to do is ensure there's proper scrutiny as well. And that we do not have.
Well, that's a real pity. Is there anything you can do in order to, force the city council to actually come out with, even taking legal action potentially to say you've got to release these documents, Tim?
Well, I'm not too sure if there's anything we can do. As councillors, I'm afraid we're in no legal position to take legal action. We just do not have the funds. If members of the public wish to challenge things, that is always open to them. I mean, the route of a judicial review is always open. As you know, I was on the fringes of one which was successful against Bristol City Council only a couple of years ago.
OK, let's move on to look at the checks and balances in all of this. And that is called an election. The local elections were cancelled this time last year. We heard I think it was in March. The announcement was made that there would be no elections. So that's meant that Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, has had a free year. It's not a lot of politicians on big salaries that can say that they've had that, although of course across the country there's quite a lot this time, including our councillors have had an extra year. This obviously is not healthy for the democratic life of the city, but what do you think the odds are about having an election this May? I mean, it seems almost incredible, Tim, to be having this conversation. Like, fingers crossed, are we going to have an election or not in 2021?
Well, I think there will be an election in 2021. I think it would be extraordinary and an attack on democracy if it was delayed out of this year. I'd say it's probably 50-50 whether it'll be this May. The issue we face is that, of course, the infection rate has got out of control and it's looking as if restrictions will still be in place as we go into the election period. There are changes they could make to make elections more secure. There are certain activities in British elections which are unique, which might need to be altered to make them more COVID safe. But the real issue here for democracy is, of course, challenge. People should have the right to be able to challenge their elected representatives and know who is standing. And at the moment, the government, as of last weekend, ordered all political parties to stop delivery of any communications. So people cannot campaign. People cannot shout out in favour of their communities or challenge those in power.
Well, I'm getting stuff through the door from, pizza companies. But you're telling me that, for example, you as the Lib Dems are not allowed to whilst pizza companies can.
They've said pizza companies and double glazing leaflets are fine, but anything to do with democracy is now illegal.
How the hell have they justified that? And that's central government, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they can't justify it. There is no justification for this. What they've said is that you can use Royal Mail to deliver. But of course, that very much then means democracy is for the rich, or perhaps for political parties such as the Conservatives, who receives millions of pounds of donations from hedge fund managers.
So how have the Lib Dems in Bristol reacted to this? Are some just saying, well, tough, we're going to deliver leaflets anyway, or not?
No, I mean, we follow the rules, and since this has begun, we've been very, very active in trying to protect our communities. And so in reality, we'd shifted a lot of our effort into that anyway, that being the priority. We did have leaflets, and I have leaflets sitting in my house that I can't deliver. We will now hold them until we're in a position to deliver them to people. I mean, we will double down and make sure people hear what our views over how our city has been run and our alternative ideas of how to run the city. I mean, number one being, of course, scrap the mayor.
Well, I mean, it almost seems like a preemptive shot across the bows, because we're just about to go into, potentially anyway, for May, an election campaign.
Yes, it is looking likely, or at least 50-50, that there will be an election in May. That probably means that at the rate things are going, people may not be able to even begin to distribute literature until the election's begun. It's going to make it quite difficult for people to knock on doors. As an example, my ward has 7,500 households in it and nearly 14,000 electors. The idea that I would have at best a few weeks to get around to try to talk to as many people as possible doesn't sound good. It also doesn't sound very COVID safe to me. Having said that, on the flip side, I am aware that a lot of people are currently holding office, including myself, who've not now really been elected to that office. And people really should have the right to have a say who their representatives are. And there's a lot of councillors desperate to let go. In fact, one resigned on Tuesday.
Well, we had Paul Smith resign as well from the City Council, who's a Labour cabinet member too. There's, you know, all sorts of reasons why people have had enough. Martin Summers, this isn't very good, is it, that we've got central government issuing these edicts, quite whether they are actually legal or not is another question, saying that politicians, political parties are not allowed to deliver leaflets because, of course, you know, particularly for the elderly who aren't, you know, particularly internet savvy, many of whom don't have any internet at all. What we're looking at really here is the youngsters who are online will have access to information about candidates and things like that, but the elderly won't have anything. They probably won't even know there's an election going on.
Well, I think one of the main things you're going to be missing is people knocking on doors and talking to people. And you can see why that might be iffy in the circumstances.
Well, you can see why it might be safe as well. Martin, you can see why it might be safe. I mean, if you had a broom handle, you can knock on the door and then you can stand back your 2 or 3 metres or whatever it has to be, and you can still have a conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think these are issues that need to be addressed. And, you know, whether it's wise to stop people putting leaflets there, as we've just been saying, you can get leaflets about double glazing. I would regard that is and pizza you could regard as being an essential service, double glazing possibly less so. But it just shows the sort of, you know, Alice in Wonderland world that we're inhabiting at the minute. But I think my feeling will be that you've got to have an election. It's not a full election in the traditional sense, because you can't just carry on not having them. And we saw in the US, for example, there was an election with lots of postal voting and so on, which then caused, all sorts of recriminations and so on. But I don't think there was really any opportunity. You know, there was no, you couldn't really have not had it. And if you can do that there, you can do it anywhere, can't you? You've just got to do it.
Yeah, I would have thought so. There are ways of doing these things. I mean, even if it involves things like, you know, spraying some sanitizer on a ballot paper and writing in a indelible ink, you know, or permanent ink or something. You know, there are ways of doing these things. I think we just maybe there's just not the political will. But look, the other aspect of all of this, Tim, is we really do need to refresh the mayor situation, and also I know the Lib Dems have been doing quite a lot to get a second referendum, saying that we don't actually necessarily have to have a mayor in Bristol. It's proved very problematic, certainly over this show. It's almost every week we've been talking about it, certainly whilst we were on FM, with the councillors that we had coming in week after week after week. Problems with the mayor, too much power, not enough accountability, an autocratic system. But the Lib Dems, I understand, are in the process of trying to make sure that Bristol people can get it changed.
Well, first, we changed the law. So originally, Bristol people had no choice to change the system. We're the only part of the country that when we adopted an elected mayor, we were stuck forever. But Barbara Jank, former leader of Bristol City Council, got put into the House of Lords, an institution we would like to abolish. But one of the few good deeds done in the House of Lords is Barbara ran an amendment to give Bristolians that right to be able to have a choice again in the future. And she managed to persuade the government that it was right, and they accepted it, and now the law has been changed. So come 2022, there has to be a 10-year gap between referendums, which is fair enough, otherwise you could be having them every year. We will have a chance to vote again. And that's one of the key things as Liberal Democrat councillors and our mayoral candidate are saying, if you vote Liberal Democrat, we will deliver on that promise. Within 50 days, we will call a council meeting to call a referendum on the position of mayor. We will set up a democracy commission to decide what the alternative running of the council should be, so people will be able to have that choice. And then in May 2022, which will be the earliest date possible under law, they could hold that referendum, a referendum would be held. If people vote to change the system, to get rid of the role of elected mayor, that means whoever is mayor would still serve till 2024, just as has happened in Torquay recently. But then the council would revert to a new way of running as decided in the referendum and through the Democracy Commission route.
Well, all I can say is well done for giving people a democratic choice to, because we had a very, very low turnout in the referendum that initially decided to have a mayor in the first place. And one might say it was kind of a honeymoon period with George Ferguson, well known around the city as well, I don't know if it's right to say philanthropist, but he certainly was somebody who was a kind of social architect, very interested in, you know, the long term, you know, in 100 years time, how will Bristol look? You know, that sort of thing, Mayor, and very close to people like the civic society. And things have kind of gone downhill since then. But anyway, Tim, also Bristol Energy has been an absolute thorn in the side of the Bristol people, because it's been literally a tap turned on back around about 4 or 5 years ago, which has just been draining more and more money ever since. And I know you mentioned it briefly earlier that the council are stopping even you scrutinising what's been going on with Bristol Energy. I understand the company has been sold. Maybe you can just bring us up to date and how much money has Marvin Rees and the mayor's office wasted on this white elephant so far, and how much longer is it going to be before it's put out of its misery?
So the bad news is the company has not been sold. And that's what many people believe. But in fact, what they did was they sold the customer books. So we've still got the company. We've still got all the bad debt. We just don't have the customer books. So the situation is that the latest accounts for up to April or March, April 2020 were published. That shows a £50 million loss by Bristol Energy. £50 million. Remember, we are the sole owner of that. So where do they look to for that money? It will be us. It will be Bristol taxpayers. But that, I'm afraid, is not the end of it. The auditor, the external auditor, in his value for money report, has revealed that Bristol Energy was at the heart of the Bristol Leap, a separate energy project by the mayor, which, of course, got stopped after spending over £10 million. And it is very clear from the auditor's report that Leap failed because of Bristol Energy. So that's another £10 million on top of Bristol Energy. So that's £60 million. Will we see more? Possibly. The council's holding an additional £7 million reserve against future costs of Bristol Energy, concerns that it may be called on to bail out further costs of the energy company. I hope that won't be called on, but that is quite possible. So in reality, we're looking at a total cost of Bristol Energy being around £60 million plus. And then, you know, there's other costs on top of that. We haven't talked about the arena. That was £12 million wasted before the mayor wrapped that one up. We haven't talked about the high payoffs, for substantial payoffs. Some of them not made following the correct procedure for high-ranking officers here in this council. We've not talked about the high-paid consultants on ridiculous amounts of money, not employed under our standard employment contracts, all done by the mayor. In total, we are looking at probably not short of £100 million of taxpayers' money having been wasted over the last 5 years. 100 million pounds.
That almost seems, you know, too much to be an error. I mean, is this some sort of sabotage operation going on here so that local authorities are really no longer able to function? We've seen others going bankrupt in other parts of the country. I mean, I suppose I shouldn't really suggest even that this is deliberate mismanagement in order to, I suppose, undermine democracy in Bristol. Would you go that far, Tim?
I think what it is you're seeing the outcome here of changing to a system where you have the power in the hands of one person without the challenge. Because I can tell you, having been on the inside in the past, having been part of that cabinet system, the challenge internally was intense, often a lot more internally than from the opposition benches. In fact, sometimes you'd come out of a meeting and one of the person who had just been shouting in your face for the last 30 minutes said, "You survived that. You can now survive the council chamber." Our internal challenge was very intense. You know, someone would propose an idea and the other half of the cabinet would take it upon themselves to rip that idea down. And the idea was, if you were still standing a few weeks later and your idea was still standing, that was worth publishing. It was worth putting out there. I don't think that occurs anymore.
No.
Because of the one person system that basically you only serve because of that person. See, we never served because of the leader of the council. We were elected directly by our group. The leader had no say who was in her cabinet. She had to put up with who the group decided. And we were ultimately answerable to all the other Liberal Democrat councillors. And the leader of council was ultimately answerable to council. Full council could remove the leader. That is, of course, we cannot do with the mayor. We have no power at all over the mayor to remove them, no matter how much money they lose.
Well, one of the interesting things about this whole debacle, we've been talking about the secrecy, etc., and Bristol Energy and the audit committee, is that even Mark Brain, who's a Labour councillor on the audit committee, has also been critical of the mayor's office.
Well, he's certainly been critical of the secrecy around this. I mean, I would say on the audit committee, councillors do try to leave their party politics at the door. We try to do our job to be a robust audit committee. And that's going to mean all councillors asking difficult questions and also putting perhaps their political allegiances to one side. But of course, when we get back into the council chamber, when we put forward motions for an independent investigation to what happened in Bristol Energy, to try to make sure it's not repeated again. Because let us remember, Bristol Energy is only one of four or five companies the council owns. And some of those other companies are going to be far greater in size than Bristol Energy. So the chance of repeating that mistake is very high if we don't learn from our mistake. And this is probably the thing which concerns us the most. It's not necessarily about going out there to hold one person to account, to stick it to them, to get some revenge. It's about trying to make sure we learn from our mistakes. We don't repeat it again. And the fact that the Labour councillors constantly vote to cover up the mayor's mistakes in the council chamber is hard to swallow.
Well, there's an interesting thread up on Twitter, which was pointed out to me. Thank you. It's lovely when listeners do this. On Bristol Live, talking about this whole confidential briefings to avoid Bristol Energy are planned. Hopefully those will happen, Tim. But then there's several responses to that, one from Totterdown Bristol. Ironic, isn't it, that Marvin Rees, at the end of Cabinet yesterday, this is earlier this week, expressed his disappointment at the lack of questions and statements submitted by councillors. Where were all the questions about losing our money? Why were not the questions asked? Well, that's a good question in itself. It's kind of supportive of what the mayor's saying. But then the Lib Dem councillor Harriet Clough says, "I've given up asking him questions because I don't get answers. I don't deal with the way he responds to being questioned. I get far more done in committee and in my specific role, to be honest," says Harriet. And then she goes on, "In the past, I've been yelled at for questioning Marvin Rees and had my PTSD deliberately and possibly maliciously triggered after I was open about my mental health being fragile." She then goes on, "You'll notice my questions were chopped off in 2018. It wasn't one of the recorded ones, unfortunately. It was contributing incident towards me having a support worker with a specialisation in PTSD. A particularly bad episodes lead to seizures. I've had ambulances," she says, "called to City Hall for me in the past." Now, this starts to look, at least according to Harriet, on this thread, which is Joanna Booth has also contributed to, like absolute out and out bullying going on with somebody who's actually got PTSD having to call an ambulance at a meeting, Tim.
Well, I think many people, if they've watched a council meeting, will see that the mayor can sometimes be fairly unreceptive to difficult questioning. The one I recall is actually not from councillors, but when an NHS doctor turned up to talk about the need for, I think, a cleaner air and tackling that issue. And unbelievably, Marvin Rees went on to lecture and attack the doctor and our local NHS workers over causing pollution through like diesel vehicles and ambulances. It was one of the most shocking and truly disgusting moments I've seen at Bristol City Council by an elected official for years. And I've got to say, I'm slightly ashamed of myself because I sat there just in shock and I did not say anything. And I think many councillors left that chamber absolutely shocked at the way the mayor behaved. I'm afraid his behaviour can be shocking on occasions. The reality is most councillors now do not bother to put statements or questions into the mayor at his cabinet meeting. He runs the cabinet meeting. He can be as rude or as aggressive as he likes. Most have given up. I occasionally do put in statements or questions, but most don't actually think that there's much value in doing that. We do have mayoral questions about once a month, and quite often he can be quite rude in that. But I had a spat with him a month or so ago, which became a little Twitter famous because I just had had enough of the way he talks. And to be honest, the way he does not answer the question. I asked a simple question, how much had been lost on Bristol Energy? And I was given the standard answer of 37 million, where everybody knows that's absolute rubbish. Everybody knows that there, you know, it was far in excess of that. And I simply said, I'm just fed up of these lies. It is, what is the point of asking you a question? So this is a problem of honesty and truth is a bit lacking sometimes. And of course, it is not just councillors and the public who've been bullied by the mayor. It is the media.
One would like to think it's less bullying. It may be just robust behaviour rather than bullying. But this sort of behaviour really is against the code of conduct for the city council itself, surely.
Well, I would say you could be right. But I think most councillors think there's simply no point wasting time making formal complaints. The complaint process is pretty loose anyway, and no one will ever do anything about the mayor. All officers serve really under the mayor. The old days that council officers served all councillors are long gone.
Martin Summers, do you want to say something about this with, you know, someone with PTSD having to call an ambulance at a meeting, a Lib Dem councillor? Does sound as if what's going on here is the replies to questions, rather than just simply answering the question, people are being personally criticised. You know, this is what you get on the internet with internet shills, isn't it? So you make a point, and then instead of replying to the point, someone on the internet will attack your character. This is really not what should be going on. This is not the proper way of running council meetings, is it?
Well, obviously, I wasn't present at any of these events, so I'm just listening with interest to what people are saying. I come back to what I said at the beginning. I'm not really in favour of having elected mayors. I never was. So the fact that there's too much power in the hands of one person isn't a problem for me to take on board, because it seems to me obvious that that's not the way to run it. And it's not the traditional way of running local authorities. It's not the way Parliament's supposed to function either. We don't have a president in this country. And that's, you know, we've got a parliamentary tradition. So this one person rule is actually quite odd. On the Bristol Energy front, Bristol Energy was originally set up during the Ferguson era. And it's grown like Topsy since then to become this huge waste of money. But just from an economic point of view, it's not really the business of local authorities, in my view, to enter into the energy industry. This is a bit of a sort of green stroke Liberal Democrat stroke New Labour idea.
I mean, the energy industry is populated by sharks.
Well, the point is that what you've got to do is nationalise the electricity industry, which, of course, was privatised by the Tories. And that functions on a massive scale. It's got monopolistic power, and it's not something that you can actually just turn by the wave of a magic wand into a competitive industry in which local authorities can enter as not-for-profit players. It's just a fantasy. So you've got a fantasy which is then turned into this massive loss-making entity, and then we've got that compounded by the secrecy of having one person rule, which means, as quite rightly been pointed out, if there is only one source of power, then they decide, you know, the officers are going to answer to them, not to the councillors collectively, and so on. So it's, you know, it's a concatenation of things over the years, you know, it's not really acceptable, is it?
Well, no, it isn't. Anyway, let's go and have a look at some of these other half public, half private businesses that the almost like sort of partnerships with Business West that have been set up. That is the main ones. We've talked about Bristol Energy, but the other main ones are to do with housing and waste, Tim.
Yeah, so we've got a few extra companies. One has already been mothballed, and that was to do with a fibre broadband system across the city. So that was mothballed after spending some money because they managed to make no income. But the two big ones are Bristol Waste, which a lot of people will know, which do all of our rubbish and recycling. And then the other one, which a lot of people won't know, but actually is probably likely to be far bigger than Bristol Energy in future, is Gorham Homes. Now, the concept of this has a universal support across the council, which was the idea that we would be involved in developing housing on council-owned land so we can deliver more affordable housing and benefit greater from the profits made from the building of housing. The concept is a good one. The worry is the local authority, in truth, knows nothing about the commercial building industry. And I think this is a point that has been made about Bristol Energy. A local authority, which is good at being a local authority, is not necessarily a good energy company. So if that is the case, also a local authority going into what can be, again, a very competitive market, which is the domestic house building market, do we actually know what needs to be known? Now, at last cabinet, the mayor was about to agree a £10 million loan to Gorham Homes, and right at the last minute, it got pulled. Interestingly enough, over a concern about the business plan, and I believe a concern about the robustness of the housing market and the likelihood of a crash, something I raised, I think, privately with officers in another meeting 9 months ago, really as this pandemic began, I said, surely one of the first things we should be concerned about is the housing market and whether or not that will crash, and Gorham Homes. And I was sort of told then that no one had done any work on that. It looks as if no one had done any work on that right up to the meeting when somebody said, hold it, actually, there is a real concern here. So it's good to see that concern is now being looked at. What we do want for the city to have enough housing for people to live in. We do want that housing to be affordable. What we don't want to do is lose tens of millions of pounds on an enterprise that is not going to be successful and not have that actually put into people's basic services, as we saw with Bristol Energy.
OK, so Martin Summers, can you just address that specific point? You know, how solid is the housing market? You know, it's one of those things you just expect it's just going to chug up and up and up. But of course, in the 80s and other times, there's been absolute collapses with people finding themselves completely bound into negative equity. So how's it looking at the moment?
Well, if you look at it, the insiders don't quite know which way it's going to go, because there's an awful lot of quantitative easing going on and so forth. Stock markets are at the highest levels they've ever been. Meanwhile, we've got the worst depression since the 30s. So, I mean, there's plenty of risk there. And I would argue that it isn't really suitable for local authorities to enter into speculative housing developments. Building affordable housing, yes, we want them to see them doing that. That's what they used to do back in the 1950s. But then they had much more control over planning and so on than they do now. So what we're doing with Bristol Energy and the housing is we're trying to reinvent the wheel of having a nationalised industry producing energy and having local authorities in charge of council housing. So we're not allowed to go back and do that because apparently that's the past and we can't do it like that. So we then come up with all these half-cracked schemes to try and reproduce what we used to do in a fairly straightforward way. And of course, the problem is if you lend money for speculative building, you're going to lose the lot.
Just looking at the Bristol City Council Code of Conduct, any of which breaches can lead to disciplinary action being taken against the mayor or anybody else. It says holders of public office must take decisions solely in terms of the public interest. They must not do so in order to gain financial or other material benefits for themselves, their family or their friends. Well, the public interest seems to be pretty clear that the public need to know the background to which decisions are being made, which affect them all, and particularly the annual budget. We've seen a similar sort of thing with legal actions in central government against NervTag and Sage, some of which have been successful, to get them to publish the minutes in which they've based their decisions. They have tried to argue in court that that these things should remain secret as part of national security. Well, God knows why you need to justify a decision on whether or not to lock a city down based on national security. Surely it should be based on medical evidence. And the other clause I've just spotted in here in the Code of Conduct is you must maintain conduct of the highest standard so public confidence in your integrity is sustained. It does sound like there may be a case to criticise possibly several people at the City Council for, if this is true, what we've been hearing from Esme about the potential bullying going on. But anyway, what about Bristol Waste, Tim? Because there's also been quite a lot of criticism of that, including large amounts of changes to budgets and things, which don't really seem to have been very well justified by Bristol Waste. Bristol Waste saying that, you know, they need hundreds of thousands of extra just to keep ticking along in the last financial year, for example.
Well, yes. I mean, like a lot of companies, Bristol Waste, of course, have been damaged by COVID. So that has hurt their budget. The issue with Bristol Waste, and it's an interesting one, is, of course, this, again, is another council-owned business. Now, unlike some of the other businesses we've discussed, this is an area the council previously did business, as in we used to run these services before they were outsourced. The danger with companies such as this is that, of course, we end up paying for the services for emptying our bins, etc. But then we end up paying a second time if they don't actually make money. What we're seeing here is, just like the other companies, it's management. The scrutiny of that company, again, is hidden behind a lot of confidentiality. In fact, the company itself is not owned by Bristol City Council. It's owned by something called Bristol Holdings Limited. Bristol Holdings Limited is then owned by Bristol City Council. So there's layer upon layer upon layer here. And there's a lot of questions of, why is this the case? Why has this been established like this? And just how can we assure the public that their money's been spent wisely? Because this is the key thing. Council should spend the public's money wisely. It's, you know, well, their money.
Back in the old days, you'd have a committee of the council with councillors overseeing directly the spending of council money. And actually, people who had something to say, for example, about fly tipping, could just go along to the council's waste committee or whoever it was that was running the bin collection services, and they could eyeball to eyeball the managers. And they could put their points, that doesn't really happen at all with these companies. They're private businesses.
It doesn't, because the companies are very secretive. So the idea that, yes, you as a member of the public could go along and address a director directly, well, good luck with that. In reality, councillors find that they rarely can do that as well. We have had one or two of the directors of the companies attend the audit committee to answer questions, sometimes in public, sometimes in private. But in reality, it is down to the executive mayor. He is the and his representatives for the running of these companies. And that is part of the problem. There is very limited scrutiny, very limited challenge of perhaps group. I'd like to say groupthink, but the problem is there isn't much of a groupthink going on. And so it's very easy for people to get set on one course. And of course, what we saw with Bristol Energy is people got too invested. They put council taxpayers' money in, and then I think they got concerned about that they would have lost money if they pulled out. So they put more money in. And it's a bit like the gambler stuck at the gambling table. They've got money already in, so they keep going. In the end, there goes the car keys, there goes the house keys. And I'm afraid we got into that situation with Bristol Energy. We should have pulled out of it far earlier on. A few years before we got to this situation, councillors were beginning to raise concerns. Members of the public were, the media were, and all of this was being ignored.
Tim, when do you think we'll get the chance to actually have another referendum? When is this, the idea of getting rid of the mayor, getting rid of the zero scrutiny, people making decisions on the backs of fag packets that aren't able?
So the absolute earliest you could have that referendum
to take place, do you think?
So the absolute earliest you could have that referendum would be 2022. That would require a vote at full council, supported by the majority of councillors and ideally, I think, probably the mayor. But you just need a majority in council to pass that motion. That would trigger a referendum. Otherwise, you need, I think, 5% of the electors of Bristol. That's 20,000. You're not allowed to start gathering those signatures till after May 2022. So that would be at the earliest May 2023. So if people vote Labour in the forthcoming elections, they're also voting to keep the current system.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of the current system, but I think and I don't really rate local government as being the main source of what goes on. I think people will vote Labour or not, depending upon their assessment of national politics. I'm afraid that's unfortunate, but it's true. And we may find a situation where there's a plurality in the political situation in Bristol is often quite finely balanced, and we'll have to see what comes out of it. Especially the Labour vote isn't necessarily about what goes on at the council, I'm afraid. It's often much more focused on national events.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen now. I'll have a look a bit more at the national scene. And you can anything more you want to add, Tim, you can do so in the next quarter of an hour or so. But I thought we'd have a listen to a guy that's written a book about the Labour Party, what's happened with the Labour Party. Obviously, it's not your party, Tim, but you may wish to comment as well. But the guy's name is Paul Embry. And I've got several clips. We might hear some in the second part. But the first one is really about the Labour Party now. His book is entitled Despised, Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. And we're going to hear now a short clip from an interview he did just a week or a couple of weeks ago. About the way the Labour Party has changed. He's saying basically that the Labour Party has abandoned the working classes, and there's this kind of middle-class Hampstead version of the Labour Party now. He's himself a former trade unionist, worked for the Fire Brigades Union, and he is appalled by the way that the working classes, he believes, have been now actually abandoned by the Keir Starmer Labour Party. So let's have a listen now to the middle class Hampstead Labour Party. Labour despised what and this, the guy's name is Paul Embry, the author of this book, Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class.
What I saw firsthand in the community where I grew up, Barking and Dagenham in East London, which was pretty much a solid Labour heartland. I know the red wall description has been applied usually to kind of northern and midland seats, but I would argue it probably applies to those sorts of seats as well. And particularly, I think, in the first decade of this century, we saw the acute effects of globalization really taking hold in some of these communities like Barking and Dagenham in terms of deindustrialization, in terms of rapid and large scale movements of people. And I think people were very uncomfortable with it. They felt that their sense of order had been violated. They didn't particularly see the benefits of globalization as it was being preached to them by politicians, particularly New Labour politicians. And I feel that that's really when the rot began to set in earnest, and Labour started to hemorrhage lots of working class votes across the country. Yeah, I do argue that Labour has always been a historic electoral compromise between its, you know, traditional blue collar working class vote and, you know, a layer of, if you like, middle class liberals who are favourable to the idea of a Labour government and a fairer society and an economy. But I think what happened with the Labour Party over the last 30 years is that it kind of took the working class element of that vote for granted. It thought that they would never have anywhere else to go. And the push that was made, with some justification, I think, by Blair in the 90s to reach out to a wider layer of middle class support. In the end, I think the pendulum swung too far to the point where now the Labour Party is pretty much all Hampstead and very little Hartlepool. And you look now at the party, and I've been a member of the party for 26 years, and it is largely a party of kind of middle class graduates based in our fashionable city, a party of kind of students and social activists. A working class element of it has disappeared, and working class people, I think, look at the party now and think, well, you guys don't particularly look like me, you don't sound like me, your priorities are not my priorities. And that ended in what we saw last December at the ballot box.
Well, he's talking there, of course, about December 2019. Martin, what do you make of this analysis that there's too many middle-class Hampstead liberals in the Labour Party and that they've lost touch with the working class?
Well, I think if you look at the demographics of how people vote, it's, as he says, it's always been a coalition between what you might call blue-collar people and, you know, people who work for councils or in schools or whatever. I think the fundamental problem, and I'm quite sure Tim will agree with me, is the electoral system. Blair was in a position where he could turn round to the traditional Labour voters and say, you've got no choice but to vote for me. So I'm now going to reach out to the middle classes, the people who want to buy their own homes, the people that are pro-Remain, if you like, whatever, because the working class in the traditional seats, not so much Barking and Dagenham, because as he says, there was a lot of churn in the population because it's part of the Greater London conurbation, much less so in places like Bolton or whatever. But I mean, the electoral system forces political parties to compete to try and win a first past the post minority of the vote in certain swing constituencies.
I mean, but with the pandemic, for example, at the moment, Martin, you know, there's millions of businesses, jobs gone. Yet where are the Labour Party with their marvellous plan to have lots and lots of jobs for people? They seem to be going along with this whole idea of, oh, it's OK, people can just go on to universal credit, or maybe some of the more extreme might even bring in the idea of a universal basic income, that people are going to take handouts forever and they're not going to have any stake in any kind of working economy.
All right, well, I'll put aside the question of the electoral system. Fundamental, though, because in May, there's going to be an election in Scotland where the SNP are going to win under PR, and then they're going to be pushing to leave the game altogether. We won't go down that road. Let's just talk about the pandemic. What the Labour Party manifesto said at the last election is everybody should have broadband. It said, in other words, so that the kids would all have something to work with at home if they're sent home from school. And of course, what's fundamental is that the banking system has collapsed. In actual fact, capitalism has stopped functioning and the pandemic is just covering that up.
Martin, that's actually not what I was asking you about. I was asking you about where is the Labour plan for people to have a stake in the society and the economy to have jobs?
There isn't necessarily going to be a full employment economy of the past. We've got to actually redistribute wealth. Basically, the Tories have borrowed far more money since the pandemic started than was ever suggested in the Labour manifesto at the last election. And they, of course, are just printing the money, which, of course, they could have done for 10 years after the banking collapse in 2008. They chose not to do it. Now, what will ultimately have to happen is, A, you can print the money, but B, you've got to actually find the money from somewhere ultimately. And that comes from basically taking it off the wealthy, the asset-owning classes, the ones who've done very well out of the pandemic, who've seen their house prices rise at the minimum. And, of course, if they are, you know, entrepreneurs in things which are making money, they're making a fortune, all of which is based on quantitative easing, so it's not based on any kind of market allocation of resources at all. So, ultimately, we're moving to a post-capitalist society, which will have to be much more redistributive. And that's what the Labour Party should be talking about, and changing the electoral system. That's a minimum as far as I'm concerned. And of course, okay, the Labour leadership are still pussyfooting around with that one. It just makes me despair.
I imagine, Tim, I imagine you'd agree with that last point. But I mean, do the Lib Dems actually have any kind of solutions for this whole idea of people having to permanently take handouts? I mean, the Great Reset and Klaus Schwab, they're now talking about people not having to work, but having enough money to sort of have a nice, cosy lifestyle from the government. And that the whole idea of people expecting to get a job and being employed may be out of the window. So anyway, what do you make of any kind of potential economic solutions for the pandemic, and also, of course, for mass unemployment, which we've seen increasing over the last 20 years or so?
Well, I think I'm going to shock you here. I think I'm one of these sort of out on the fringe people, because the Liberal Democrats have actually backed universal basic income. We've decided that actually that should be a fundamental human right. I agreed with a lot of what Martin actually just said there, not necessarily everything, but a lot of it. I think there's a couple of things to look at here. One is the effects of globalization. I think that's true. Too many people have been left behind, and globalization has suited a lot of people in the middle classes and has hurt a lot of people in the working classes. And I'm beginning to think, what's the answer to that? Because, I mean, I come from Cornwall, so we got hit by globalization in 1867. So we've been through this a little bit earlier than perhaps the rest of the UK. So our industry started to be destroyed in 1867. That was a Great Depression in Cornwall, when the tin mines collapsed and the fishing fleet came home with no fish. So starvation was rampant in Cornwall and everybody left. Cornwall depopulated then over the next 40 years. So how can we avoid that here? So one of the key things, I think, is one, to make sure you are meeting people's basic needs, which is a universal basic income. Then two, give them the power to improve their lives, and that's through education. So I think one of the key things we see is, certainly in Bristol we saw, and when I first moved here it was obvious, is the worst education results, the lowest achievements, were in the poorest areas. We've got to flip that. We've got to make sure the best education results are in the areas which have the least income. We've got to make sure those people have the greatest opportunity in future. And we've got to make sure education doesn't just stop at 18. We've got to make sure you can keep going back into education, which you can do more now, but a lot of people are not aware of that. And we've got to promote that continued learning. We've got to be able to reskill people, because the reality is putting up walls, the Trump style of stopping globalization, doesn't actually work. It just delays it. So that doesn't help people in the long term. So what you've got to do is you've got to front up to the effects of globalization and say, hey, some people are going to lose their jobs because of this. So what we're going to do is we're going to get you better jobs, and we're going to help you get there. And I think that really is where people should be focusing. But hey, I'm just a liberal, so what do I know?
One person who's been talking particularly recently I haven't heard hardly anyone really going into this, is the effect that these lockdowns are having on, particularly on young people, on the lack of schooling, that sort of thing. I mean, I'm always reminded of the quote by Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann: every educated person is a future enemy. And one of the reasons I sort of go for as much education and good quality critical thinking education as possible is as a reaction to what one of the most evil men on the planet ever said about education. But Neil Oliver, the TV presenter and the author of the books and the television series Coast, etc., has been looking at these, what he believes is a really pernicious social disintegration, which is going on right now, the longer these lockdowns are extended. So let's have a listen to him speaking on talk radio earlier this week. Neil Oliver now.
There's a profoundly moving sequence in Primo Levi's If This Is a Man. In one of the camps, he talks about very early on encountering an older man who's washing, getting washed at the sink, and the water's foul and it's cold and there's no way to get dried apart from using his clothes. And Primo Levi says to him, why do you even bother? And the older man says, you've got to maintain the scaffolding.
Yes.
You have to maintain the skeleton of who you are. Now, I'm not making comparisons. comparisons between the two. I merely use that to illustrate the point that it's so easy at the moment to think, oh, I'll just stay in my pyjamas or I won't even get out of bed because there's nothing to get out of bed for. And you know, it's impossible to overstate the importance of galvanizing people into getting back into routines that are physical. You know, we need the physical, and it's all well and good that you can get everything delivered. You can get all your food delivered. You can get takeaway food delivered. You don't need to talk to another living soul. You can just binge watch box sets or something or whatever. But you need the physical structure to the day. You know, because you need as functioning human beings, you need to get up at the same time every day, have a routine, do things. And it sounds ridiculous to be saying that, but I don't think so. I think it's vitally important to get people, you know, to get people moving. And for want of access to loved ones and crowds and the proper socialising that we all want to do, you know, because otherwise you're going to see the dissolution of society. Mm. It does start to come apart, and you can't say, "Oh well, it's only been this amount of time; we don't need to worry about it yet."
Yeah.
So that's Neil Oliver there, the TV presenter, talking on talk radio. Martin, I suppose this is really about self-discipline, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there are issues surrounding how people can cope with the current circumstances and whether, you know, keeping a routine is a good or a bad idea, probably a good idea and so on. But there's the wider question of lockdowns or no lockdowns, and we know that that's been in the news this week with Desmond Swain and others pushing for, you know, and the right wing of the Tory party pushing for an early end to lockdowns. But of course, across on the other side of the planet in New Zealand and China, there is no lockdown. The economy's running. Everything's back to normal because they did it right and we did it wrong. And I'm afraid we've got incompetence in charge and we've ended up with the short straw. And there's no easy answer to that one.
Well, you could say the short straw, but that short straw is because the disease COVID-19 was spreading around here. Well, we believe certainly in the BBC in Bristol from the 17th of December when a film crew came back and spread it around the office in the BBC. And you won't hear that on Points West. So in December, January, February, March, if it was spreading around in Bristol, Martin, for 3 months before Jacinda locked down and we locked down roughly the same time in mid-end of March, of course, it's not really at all fair, is it? And in fact, it's intellectually dishonest.
Well, no, because look at what's happened in China, Bristol, Tony, where it's
intellectually
supposedly
Martin, it's intellectually dishonest.
Deaths.
Martin, it's intellectually dishonest to try and compare what happened in the UK to New Zealand, isn't it?
I'm comparing it to China. New Zealand was lucky, so was Iceland. They've got opportunities. Taiwan is right next to China. They've had 7 deaths. In China itself, they've had less than 4,000. We're up to 100,000, Tony. It's because the people in charge don't know what they're doing and they keep changing their mind.
Well, there's all sorts of questions about these statistics, but let's try and get back to the point.
I think they're overwhelming, though, aren't they, Tony? We're not talking about a factor of 10 here.
The point in question, yeah, well, there are all sorts of questions about the statistics, which Desmond Swain has been quite rightly, in my mind, bringing up, which we'll hear about in part two this week. Tim, what do you make of this whole thing of people having nothing to do? And I suppose in the past where people have, you know, a kind of discipline imposed on them by their work, by their job, we're suddenly left with having to impose self-discipline, working from home, maybe for the first time for many years. And, of course, the devil will find work for idle hands to do.
Well, I think it's been tough for people, but I think the one thing about humans is we're remarkably adaptive. So I think the majority of me being able to adapt to it. The key thing is, we've got to get on top of this virus. The key thing is we've got to give time to roll out the vaccinations, which we are now doing. I agree a lot with what Martin just said about the figures there. I think, you know, there have been some bad decisions by our government. There's been some good decisions as well, but there's been some bad decisions. There's no doubt about it. The death toll here in this country is uniquely high compared to other countries. You can argue about the edges of the figures, but the main thrust of the figures are obvious that something's gone wrong here. And I would just say there's no such thing as good comments and Desmond Swain being said in the same sentence. The man's a complete and utter idiot.
Well, we'll hear from Desmond Swain himself, see what he thinks, see what Martin thinks of him. He'll probably tear into little shreds. But I thought we'd just finish off the first part with Councillor Tim Kent. I suppose I should call you unelected councillor for Henbury and Whitchurch Park. Is it Hengrove or Henbury?
Hengrove, thank you.
Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim. The unelected councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. By having a listen to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday this week, and it'll be your both of you's final chance in the first part to give us your take on exchanges really going on between Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition Labour Party, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson at Prime Minister's questions. So here is Starmer asking a question about the pandemic to Boris Johnson.
Mr. Speaker, every week the Prime Minister comes with his pre-prepared lines. I think when 100,000 people have died, he should take the time to answer the question. But when one in three families are saying that they don't have enough laptops or computers, his answers are simply not good enough. We're nearly a year into this pandemic. This hasn't happened in the last few weeks. And one in three families say they don't have the wherewithal to do home teaching. And those children are going without home schooling. That's the question the Prime Minister should be answering. Mr. Speaker, the UK is the first country in Europe to record 100,000 COVID deaths. We also have the deepest recession of any major economy. Our schools are closed and our borders are open. And my biggest concern is that the Prime Minister still hasn't learnt the lessons of last year. And I fear that as a result, we'll see more tragedy and more grim milestones. Now, this afternoon, I will be speaking to families who've lost loved ones to COVID. The last time I did this, I asked the Prime Minister what he would like me to say to them on his behalf. He replied with a pre-prepared, childish gag. I can tell the Prime Minister just how badly that went down with those families when I spoke to them later that afternoon. So I'll ask him again, and I hope this time he'll have the decency to answer them properly. What would he like me to say to those bereaved families on his behalf this afternoon?
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the right honourable gentleman for meeting the families of the bereaved, as I have done, and I know members across the House have done throughout the pandemic. And it's important that we do that. And the message I would give those families is the same as I've given everybody I've met, is that I, of course, deeply personally regret the loss of life, the suffering of their families, Mr. Speaker. But I think the best thing that we can do to honour the memory of those who have died and to honour those who are currently grieving is to work together to bring this virus down, to keep it under control in the way that we are. And Mr. Speaker, throughout this pandemic, I'm sad to say that the leader of the opposition has never failed in his efforts to try to score political points when I think he could be doing just that. And he has twisted and he has turned, and one week he calls for tougher border measures after the Shadow Transport Secretary called for looser quarantine. He calls for schools to go back. He won't even say this morning that schools are safe. He tries to associate himself now with the vaccine programme because he senses that that may be going well, Mr. Speaker. But he stood on a manifesto to unbundle the pharmaceutical companies, the big pharma, Mr. Speaker, that made those vaccines possible. And he actually attacked the vaccine task force. I know you want me to sit down, Mr. Speaker. I don't want to make this point because I tried to make it last week. He even attacked the vaccine task force for spending £675,000 on an effort to discover whether hard-to-reach groups would take a vaccine. And I really cannot think of a better investment right now of public funds. And I hope that later on this afternoon, the Right Honourable Gentleman may think of apologising for what he did and for that attack on the vaccine task force. Mr. Speaker, they can go on, and the Right Honourable Gentleman can go on making his party political points. We will go on, with or without his help, in taking this country forward, fighting the pandemic and getting coronavirus down. Yeah.
Martin, do you want to respond to that? Do you think Boris has got any traction at all there against Mr. Starmer?
I don't think he did. I mean, there's going to have to be some public inquiry into this at some point. And one of the things that the Prime Minister was saying this week, now isn't the time. And you think, well, when is the time to have a public inquiry? Many of the bereaved groups of bereaved families are saying that they want an inquiry immediately so that we can stop making the mistakes that we've been making so far. And I think that ultimately there will be a reckoning for all of this. Starmer has basically, you know, he's tried to ask questions about what's going on. And he's generally, politically, when he's called for lockdowns and the government, for example, sent everybody back to school at the beginning of the term and everybody went in for one day and then they decided that they weren't going to go back because it was a silly idea. Now, that just shows that you don't know what you're doing, I'm afraid, and that's beyond party politics.
I mean, aren't these decisions really being made by the SAGE committee, people like Jeremy Greenstock, the chairman of the Wellcome Foundation, that these big organisations are really making this policy rather than the cabinet?
Well, it's quite clear that the Prime Minister has not been listening to what the SAGE recommendations are. So, I mean, he basically took the political decision that he was going to ignore what they said. And of course, it now looks pretty silly to have this so-called eat out to help out, which turns out to have got us into a third lockdown. All of these things are going to come out in a public inquiry. So we could go on about them now, but it will come out. But it's pretty clear that they've basically messed this up. And I don't think they're going to get out of that. They're going to be caught on that one, whatever they do now.
Well, these elections, if they're allowed to happen, if we're allowed to have elections in May, will certainly be a sign of what the public makes of all of this. But Tim, anyway, what do you think of the exchange between Starmer and Boris there? Because I'm sure there's millions of members of the public that have been clamouring to know, what is your plan to get out of this? When are we going to stop? When is there going to be no more lockdowns? Because we've even been hearing this week that maybe the vaccines won't give us, particularly the most vulnerable and elderly, very much or enough immunity, which seems to me like the goalposts have shifted there as well by the scientists this time. So what do you make of where we're heading and if possible, heading out of pandemic and out of lockdown?
Well, the vaccines are route out. Actually, what was released by Germany was no different to what the British scientists said on the day they approved the vaccine. They actually themselves covered that whole topic of that there was not a great deal of data for the over 65s, but they had enough data everywhere else. So nothing new came out of Germany. The only difference was there was a bit of hype around what was said. So the vaccine is our way out. I'm far more interested in what the Prime Minister has done than whether the leader of the opposition has or has not attacked this or that. It is the Prime Minister that has made decisions. I agree, we're getting to a point now where we really must start the independent inquiry. The Prime Minister had already agreed to it, I think several months ago, actually, to Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats. He agreed there would be an independent inquiry. I think we're at a point where probably after Easter that should start up. We do not need to wait till the end of this because it will never completely end. The reality is COVID is so spread now that it probably will be around now for many years to come. But we will just have to vaccinate as people do against the flu and against many other diseases and viruses. And the reality is modern medicine has protected us for much of this for many years. And they have shown that given a considerable amount of money being put to them, they can do it again. But at the same time, as we come out of this, we also need to look at the long term damage. And in particular, that is going to be around poverty, the economy and our children and their future.
Well, I can tell you what my submission to the public inquiry will be is why has there not been use of ivermectin and chloroquine, particularly on early COVID patients, which some studies have shown up to 90% cure rates, particularly with ivermectin, which is it's an anti-parasitic drug, but it has this bizarre, unexpected effect on the SARS, and it did. In fact, it was tested in the original SARS outbreaks in 2003, and they found that it had a dramatic effect. And yet insurance companies, bizarrely, will not insure medical institutions who use these drugs like ivermectin and chloroquine on patients, even though the tests have shown, and more studies all the time are showing, that many patients, you know, possibly hundreds of thousands of people, could have been saved if these drugs had been used, which sounds bizarre, but these drugs have been being used in places like Asia and Africa to great effect, only not here. And one has to ask questions about that. So that would be my little question to the inquiry. Martin, what about yours?
It'll be questions about, you know, the fundamental questions are going to be, why did you not lock down soon enough? Why did you release too soon? And those are going to be the major focuses, because it's like playing football. I mean, Marcus Rashford can score goals. You people can't even defend.
What's your plan to get out of this then?
We're going to have to stay as locked down as we need to until we've got rid of it and the vaccines have done their job. And that means there's going to be a much bigger hit on the economy than would otherwise have been the case. And I think Rishi Sunak is going to have to answer some questions about that.
Okay, well, thanks very much to our guest, Tim Kent, Lib Dem Council and Bristol City Council, also on the audit committee, and keeping a good close eye on our mayor, as close as he can, as close as the mayor will let him, and also making sure that people in Bristol know, the council taxpayers, when we are not being told information, which, of course, the idea is that there will be no news stories because there will be no press release from the mayor's office. But thankfully, the Lib Dems will be informing us, and Tim particularly, and others, when things are not being shared in a kind of corporate, in a way rather like a corporate boardroom, don't want to share their little secrets, their nasty little secrets, and things that they're up to with the public. It completely goes against, in my view, goes against the whole public service ethos and indeed Bristol City Council's own code of conduct, which I read out earlier on, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So thank you, Tim. And we'll be back with Martin after we've heard some music. And this time we're going to be hearing from Stereo Lab, a great favourite band of mine from 1994. And, someone we don't hear enough of on the radio, that's Tracy Chapman. Dum 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 d
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds peaceful. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds peaceful. Who are people gonna rise up, get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's there? Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution.
Well, that's Tracy Chapman, and before that you heard Stereolab and a song called Ping Pong. And we are having a look first here tonight at hacking in the US elections. Well, it's not the Venezuelans, the Russians, Cambridge Analytica, or even China. Biden, by the way, is known to be particularly friendly with China. And the enemy within this time, it's Professor Robert Epstein. He's a Democrat, but he says his research on Google algorithms indicates a roughly 30 percentage point swing from Biden, sorry, to Biden from Trump for anybody foolish enough to research the candidates on the Google search engine. Plus a closer look at the oligarchs who hope to take over the world, Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab. That look by Scottish journalist turned civil liberties podcaster Natalie Minnis. So, Martin Summers, can we just start with this incredible story from, I mean, actually, it's a while ago, this, but it's passed me by. But we have covered this guy, Robert Epstein, before. Nothing to do, of course, with Jeffrey Epstein. This guy is a doctor, and he is this is in the midst of the actual election itself, publishing. He's a Harvard-trained Democrat. He's disclosing findings from his 2020 election research, saying that he reckons a 30% swing. But he's saying at least 6 million votes swung from Biden, from Trump to Biden. I keep saying that. I don't know why. But I'll just read you out the little bit from WorldNet Daily. Google's search engine manipulation in the 2020 election could have shifted a minimum of 6 million votes to Democrat Joe Biden, according to research psychologist Dr. Robert Epstein. The Harvard-trained researcher, Democrat voter, told Fox News' Tucker Carlson that he had 733 field agents in the swing states of Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida collecting data. Field agents, he calls them. Sounds almost like the CIA, doesn't it? But Google search results were strongly biased in favor of liberals and Democrats. This was not true on Bing or Yahoo. The researchers collected 500,000 election-related searches, which is about 30 times more data than his team collected back in 2016. They found 4 years ago as WND WorldNet Daily reported in an interview with Epstein, that biased results generated by Google's algorithm likely impacted undecided voters in a way that gave at least 2.6 million votes to Hillary Clinton and as many as 10.4 million. Epstein noted the bias was being shown to pretty much every demographic group we looked at, including conservatives. Conservatives got slightly more bias in their search results than liberals did. So how do you account for that, he asked. Well, the researchers also found out what he called a smoking gun. We found a period of days when the vote reminder on Google's homepage was being sent only to liberals. Not one of our conservative field agents received a vote reminder during those days. He said, after going public with our findings, Google, he believes, backed off. They literally shut off that manipulation that night. And so 4 days before the election, they were showing vote reminders to everybody, finally. So this is a whole aspect to vote rigging, Martin, that we don't really get covered by the BBC or anybody much in the international Western media. And it's the idea that the search algorithms can be used to swing elections. In this case, what Robert Epstein is alleging here himself is he reckons at least 6 million votes.
Well, I'm totally unsurprised by this. I mean, Google is a corporation, and it's got its what it what you know. It's not a public body, and just as if you pick up the Daily Mail, you're not going to find Jeremy Corbyn being given a fair crack of the whip. Google, given the existing setup, are perfectly within their rights to fiddle the search. It's not fiddling the searches, because they don't, you're not guaranteed. If you use Google as a search engine, you're basically saying, I want to use Google, and therefore they've got you over a barrel. And of course, this is the way in which all political campaigns are now functioning. They're trying to target micro segments of the electorate in order to send them the things which are going to change their minds in the direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's not about the same as they advertise. I want an unbiased. I'm going to do an unbiased search.
Micro targeting.
You're not saying I'm going to do a search anymore. You're saying I trust Google to do the search for me.
And well, indeed, you know, just as people pick up newspapers or listen to the BBC, the BBC is a public body, and therefore there is some comeback if they're shown to be biased in what they're presenting. But Google should be nationalised and made to function as a public
service. Their complaints process is just about as effective as Bristol City Council's complaints process, in my experience. And this, of course, is why people don't bother engaging with it, because they find it doesn't actually operate for them.
I would argue that these monopolistic tech companies should be taken into public ownership and run as a public utility, just like the banks should be. But while they're run as a private enterprise, which is what they are, then you see what's happening is the right wing are complaining now that Google's got a liberal bias. But of course, they've got their Fox News, which doesn't have a liberal bias. It's got a pro-Trump bias, but they don't complain about that.
Well, I think Epstein
Fox News have to give Biden a fair crack of the whip. And the answer is, in the current setup, no, they don't have to.
Epstein is a fascinating guy. I think he says he's famed. He's a famed behavior. He was famed behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner's last PhD student at Harvard. Yeah. He's been a research psychologist for nearly 40 years, served in various editorial positions at Psychology Today magazine and Scientific American. Scientific American Mind, which is not Scientific American. It must be some sort of offshoot of it. He's the author of 15 books and more than 300 scientific and mainstream articles on artificial intelligence and other topics. In testimony a year ago to the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, he emphasized he is not a conservative. I'm here today, he says, for three reasons: to explain why Google presents a serious threat to democracy and to human autonomy, to explain how passive monitoring systems can protect us both now and in the future from companies like Google, and to tell you how Congress can immediately end Google's worldwide monopoly on search. Well, they don't totally have a monopoly, but, you know, they basically do, don't they, Martin? You know, everyone uses it. In fact, we use the word Google like we used to use the word Hoover. You know, it's just a brand name instead of actually what the purpose of the job should be. And it's got a tremendous amount of trust. And they've managed somehow, Google, I don't know how they've done this, but to just have this kind of fluffy, cuddly, we trust Google, we love Google feel to them for many people. In fact, you know, many people do trust their entire correspondence to Google, which they shouldn't do. I mean, I remember finding out when I was writing for Russia Today that I'd sent an email which contained an article I'd just written about Google to the Gmail address of one of the staff at RT, because they were finding that it was if people were sending from Gmail addresses, they wouldn't arrive at the RT's own in-house email addresses. Google must have been censoring those. But once the RT staff opened Gmail accounts, these articles by various correspondents started arriving. And so I sent my to a Gmail account at RT about Google, and it never arrived. It just got disappeared and, you know, spirited away down a plug hole on its way to RT. And that was one of the things that alerted them to that. Then from then on, they asked people to send articles to two email addresses, to their Gmail address and also to the in-house address. But there's an enormous amount of potential with a monopolistic company like Google, Martin, who's working now very closely, of course, with Bill Gates' Microsoft, to use that monopoly to control communications rather than facilitate them.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same problem. I mean, Noam Chomsky pointed this out years ago. I mean, basically, these are money-making corporations, and they are, they're basically selling you soap powder, telephones, all sorts of things, and they also
a lot of their wealth, of course, is in tax havens, isn't it? And they put themselves in legal jurisdictions. They base themselves in places where they pay no tax, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, they're profit maximizing private enterprise monopolies, and the ultimate, I would argue, that they should ultimately be put in as run as public utilities, and that means that they would have an obligation to make sure that if you make a search, the whole idea behind the internet was if you put in a search term, what most other people were looking for, that would come up first. Whereas, of course, what they're doing now is they are basically manipulating the feed that you get on your smartphone as you're going around about your business. Now, ultimately, this is the way society is going in general. So, of course, other corporations that want to sell stuff are micro targeting their advertising and all the rest of it, making sure you don't see certain things and that you do see other things. And that just spills straight over into politics. And, if people running electoral campaigns, particularly in the US, where there's a huge amount of money invested in these campaigns, they've got tech people who are basically trying to manipulate the feeds of people on their smartphones. Now, the only way to stop this is, I mean, you could just say, well, that's just how it is. You know, we're going to have Google over here, and then you could set up an alternative, which would be a conservative version, like Cambridge Analytica were accused of doing exactly that. You've also got intelligence agencies out there, you know, your Brigade 77, your Israelis tech industry people who are trying to manipulate the information flow. And we're saturated in information, but it's all manipulated. And we need to take a step back and create a public space, which is a genuinely public space, so that elections could be more free and fair. But, that's part of the whole process of trying to change the political system so that it's more responsive.
It'd be nice if we could even just have elections at all. That would be good. But this Bilderberg Big Tech is quite a bizarre phenomenon, isn't it? Can you imagine meeting Eric Schmidt down the pub and saying, well, you know, how much for 6 million votes to swing in your direction? I mean, let's make it clear. Well, the way that Google does this is it ups positive stories about candidates and downs negative stories about them, yeah, if it's trying to promote them, and it does the opposite.
Yeah, but that's
on
exactly
the other side. If there's a candidate that it wants to make look bad, that what it will do is it will boost up the negative stories about that candidate on the searches, and it uses its algorithms to do that, but it makes nothing public about the fact that that's what it's doing. And then, of course, the other thing about these massive Bilderberg big tech firms is that they are using vast amounts of energy. This is something which is hardly ever addressed in the green debate. Last year, in March 2020, on the BBC, there was a documentary called Dirty Streaming, The Internet's Big Secret, which is still available on the iPlayer, I believe. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Plus, in November, ITV dispatches, oh sorry, Channel 4 dispatches, broadcast a superb documentary called "Is Your Online Habit Killing the Planet?" Where a chap called Ian Bitterlin, he is talking about the massive extra energy being used by the data centers of people like Amazon and Google, as well as 5G massively increasing the amount of energy that is needed. I don't know if you want to guess, Martin, how what percentage of the Irish grid, what they're doing now, of course, many of these places are based in Ireland, and the Irish, well, it's a bit silly asking you to guess it, but it's now something like 41. It was 2% of the Irish grid a few years ago. It's now coming up to 41% of the electrical grid in Ireland is being used to feed these 5G networks and these data centres. So I'll put a link to that on our show page. That documentary is called was in November 2020, and it's called, you can still watch it, it's "Is Your Online Habit Killing the Planet? Sophie Morgan investigates the carbon footprint of the tech industry as she discovers some shocking truths about the hidden cost of our online habits." And this guy, Ian Bitterlin, on there is actually someone who helps design data centres, although I don't know if he's getting any contracts from Amazon or Google anymore. But he's basically spilling the beans on the vast amounts of energy that this new technology is taking up. And, of course, that's not green at all. It's making massive demands on existing networks, and it's making electricity for everyone else much more expensive.
Yeah, well, I mean, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are notoriously energy, you know, they just use massive amounts of energy. I mean, I think our whole civilization is, you know, incredibly energy intensive, and that we talk a lot about reducing our energy intensivity. But in practice, the thrust of the system is to just use more and more stuff and sell more and more stuff. And, you know, basically, that nothing much has changed apart from the rhetoric.
But I mean, the thing is, Martin, these companies, the point being, these companies sell themselves as, oh, we're so fantastically green. It means you can buy it all online. You can do stuff. You can watch it, stream it online. Actually, they are just simply making decisions with no government and no people being involved. They're cocking a snook, really, at the whole of society and saying we're going to do what we want anyway.
Yeah, and of course, it's what's particularly ironic is, as you say, that a company like Google will present itself. I mean, they're fairly upfront about saying that they've got a liberal politics. I don't think anybody disputes that, you know. But of course, that means that they're very down on conservative points of view, but they're also very down on socialist points of view, where we might say, well, let's just nationalise you. There's no reason for you to be making a profit out of this at all. We could run it as a public utility, and they certainly wouldn't want to hear that sort of, you know, you wouldn't get very far with that. And of course, as you can see around the world, you know, in places like China and Russia, they're trying to develop an alternative infrastructure which isn't controlled by the West. For all of these things, so they're developing their own cryptocurrencies, their own platforms to do things and so on, because they're very well aware of how manipulative this can be. And don't forget, all of this high tech stuff was set up originally with Pentagon money, and these people are all in the pockets of the Pentagon, and of course at the same time as pretending to be very liberal and all the rest of it. It's I mean, you know, it's predicted in situationist theory from the 1950s and 1960s that you're going to eventually have this kind of capitalism which promises everybody freedom and individual liberty and, you know, networking and all the rest of it. But it's basically all a con, and the same old people are behind the scenes pulling the strings.
Well, that's right. And it's always been the way, isn't it? The Guardian reporting last month that 10 billionaires, including Jeff Bezos, of course, at Amazon, who seems to reap the benefit of all of this stuff, their net wealth is up $400 billion as a result of the pandemic. So, you know, these people are just simply sitting there rubbing their hands and saying, told you so. And they love the pandemic because, of course, it's shifting what was a very sort of slow move from the high street to online retail. And of course, a similar thing from cash to electronic money, that has massively been massively accelerated by this. And of course, these people are all massively invested in this area. So there's other, and Business Insider is saying a different figure from 400 billion. They reckon the billionaires, the 10 billionaires, got roughly $640 billion richer during the COVID-19 pandemic. So that is, you know, these people are doing incredibly well. It's almost like
the other thing. Which
this is their world, Martin. This is their world.
It is. And the other thing you haven't mentioned is the massive bailouts of the financial services sector. So that has been covered up by COVID, but it actually in September last year, in 2019, sorry, not last year, so in 2019, the banks were offering each other 10% interest overnight rates. So we were back to a credit crunch as in 2008, and then loads and loads of money was printed, and they were showered with extra cash to keep the whole system going, which means, of course, that everybody who is a billionaire is basically being given free money to carry on making more money as a billionaire. Asset prices are still rising in stock markets, even as the real economy around the world is in turmoil. Stock markets are showing the highest values ever, which is simply to do with printing money. It's got nothing to do with inventing a better widget. And of course, that's the ideology of capitalism, that the reason why these guys are rich is because they're so brainy and that they've invented a better way of doing things. But if you allowed the banks to collapse, they'd all lose all their money.
Well,
like Trump may lose all of his money now he's out of power and end up with nothing. He's not a big businessman at all. What? He's worth nothing. He's bankrupt.
Well, one of the places, of course, that these people put their money is in companies like Moderna, whose vaccine is just being criticised this week. But the point being here is they're not interested in whether the Moderna vaccine for COVID is safe or anything else that Moderna have ever done. And by the way, they've never done anything else. They're only a hedge fund company that's been supported by hedge funds on speculation that they might make a lot of money. And these billionaires keep pumping cash into them with all these harebrained schemes that might end up making some money and might not. But the reason they've managed to convince the hedge funds to invest in Moderna, Martin, is simply because they say even though their vaccine might not be safe, it will come quicker to market. And so it will be the first one that governments buy, that they will be able to make more profit for shareholders. And the safety question isn't really even considered when that money arrives at the chief executive of Moderna's office.
Well, especially if they've been given indemnity by governments who are looking for a quick result so that Moderna can't be sued if it is dangerous. And of course, in other parts of the world, the Russians have developed a public sector vaccine, Sputnik. The Cubans have developed their own versions. The Chinese are trying to develop their versions. And of course, there's a big debate out there about who's going to get vaccines on what basis. And of course, the big pharma in the West is determined to keep the patents on all of these vaccines and make sure that they get their money back.
Well, of course.
And of course, at the same time, loads of public money has been ploughed in. I mean, you've had quotes from Bill Gates on here before saying we need the public sector to come in, and then the private sector will bring in the expertise.
Well Martin.
But the public sector's got to underwrite the whole thing. Well, if you're going to do that, you might as well just run it as a public sector enterprise, mightn't you?
Exactly.
And not make any private profit out of it at all.
Yeah, and also it might be much better open to scrutiny rather than everything
Indeed.
Being done behind
Indeed.
Closed doors. But look, what do you make of this spat this week over the AstraZeneca vaccine by Ursula von der Leyen, saying the British are being mean, the company's being mean? They've got their Pfizer vaccine, which is a Euro vaccine, and the British one, the Oxford AstraZeneca one, the Europeans are getting very cross because they don't think that they're getting enough of these. Now, is it justified, or do you think that this is a kind of political squabble that people are trying to make political points out of what is a genuine problem in actually manufacturing enough?
Well, I mean, it's being seen through the lens of national competition, as it were. But you've got to remember, all the AstraZeneca vaccine has been produced by teams across the whole of not just Europe. And the same goes for the Pfizer vaccine, which is much more expensive, of course. And, of course, we've signed up for a hell of a lot more of that one, which is going to cost us a lot more. What we could have done is we could have gone in with the Chinese and the Russians and had vaccines much cheaper for everybody. But we don't do that. Why don't we do that? I mean, at one stage, the Americans put on sanctions on the laboratories in Russia which had developed the Sputnik vaccine on the grounds that they were basically warfare related, and therefore they were going to try and squeeze them out of the international market.
Well, that may be because
which was absurd. You'd have thought everybody ought to be working together on this to try and get as many vaccines out there as possible, as safely as possible.
Are they betraying that they believe that, and they know maybe even that COVID was a biological weapon, and that this was a?
But we can come to that as we widen the discussion. I'm very suspicious about everything to do with this, because the usual profiteers are profiteering, and they do that anyway. You know, when things happen which are bad, pharmaceutical companies are in the business of making money out of human misery. Let's face it. They're curing people of illnesses, so illness is part of their business plan. And there's some quote from a Goldman Sachs guy sitting on one of the boards saying, curing people is a rubbish business plan.
What they want is chronic illness, which goes on for years and years. This is better for their business model.
Yeah, well, I mean, AstraZeneca, working with Oxford University, are claiming that they're producing for cost, effectively. And the row, of course, is simply because the EU have put lots of their public money into developing it, just as the British have. And they're squabbling now about who's going to get the vaccines. But I mean, if you look in the wider picture in the whole world, I mean, in the developing world, lots of countries are going towards buying the Sputnik vaccine because it's cheaper. And they think they can get more bang for their buck with the Russian.
You know what would be great, wouldn't it, if all of these different vaccines weren't just in competition, but we had some honest scientists actually openly looking at them and saying, "Well, actually, it's quite clear this one is the most effective."
What the Russians said, because when the sanctions were put on them by the Americans, they said this is ridiculous because we've already shared all of our information with the AstraZeneca teams. And that's what should be happening, surely. I mean, that's very good.
Happening. I mean,
everybody ought to be working hard to produce a basic vaccine that everybody can use.
Well,
there shouldn't be any competition to make money out of it.
Well, thank
competition
God.
Competition should simply be to come up with the best ideas and pass them around as quickly as possible.
Well done to the Russians, and thank God not everybody is just trying to cash in on this pandemic. But anyway,
they are trying to cash in a way. Because what they're doing is by going out to places like Argentina and knocking out their vaccine for cost, they're building friends and influencing people. Just as the Tory government here has decided to cut foreign aid from the budget because it's quite popular amongst their voters. But of course, the Russians are going out there and giving the stuff away for free. And in the long run, it's actually a battle for the control of hearts and minds. And if you cut back on things like that at a time like this, the Russians and the Chinese are going to come in there and say, well, if they don't want to help you, we do.
Okay, so looking at some wider questions with the new Biden presidency, Biden is pressing Putin this week on the Navalny arrest in a phone call. I suppose it's a transatlantic phone call from Moscow to Washington, Biden and Putin, and a massive cyber hack in his first phone call. The Kremlin has described the conversation as businesslike and frank in nature. One of the things that, I mean, there's lots discussed, Martin, including Navalny and this cyber hacking by the Russians, allegedly, in the US. But one of the most important things, I think, that's come out of that is this appeal by Putin to Biden to sign the new START treaty, saying, well, look, a lot of this has been torn up under Trump. You know, let's just let the people of the world breathe a sigh of relief and re-sign the START treaty on nuclear weapons to limit the supplies, and also to be exchanging information about nuclear weapons. Really, to it makes some sort of nuclear exchange impossible. That's the aim of it. But Putin's main thrust was just to get START renewed. He seems to be focused on that one, Martin.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that Biden has indicated that he's willing to go back to the START treaty. It's not clear whether he's going to do anything similar with the Iranian nuclear deal. They're definitely not, because they've got, the influence of the Israelis on that is too strong for them, probably. And we're going to see which way he's going to jump on various things as this develops. But I mean, that's potentially positive, because that's been in place since the 1980s, worked very well. There's no reason to scrap it. The reason why Trump was scrapping it is because they want to deploy short-range missiles against the Chinese. And the Chinese basically, you know, and they can't do that while their hands are tied by the START treaty with the Russians on intermediate missiles. But I mean, if they decide that the common sense dictates that we should, I mean, just stick to the existing agreements we've got. I mean, there's still enough nuclear missiles and warheads out there to destroy us many times over. There's overkill of every kind. And of course, they were pushing for the Chinese to be involved in these negotiations. Now, they've only got a few hundred warheads. The Russians and the Americans have got thousands between them. So the Chinese are saying, well, you know, you can't really involve us in this because all we've got is enough to nuke you if you nuke us. And we're not really interested in developing it further than that. So you can't drag us into this. We're not going to be, you know, that was a piece of gamesmanship by the Americans to try and drag the Chinese in. And the Chinese said, well, it's nothing to do with us. If you want to negotiate with us about our nuclear weapons, that's a different matter. But anyway, that's potentially positive. But of course, there's a lot of negatives as well. I mean, a lot of the Democrats and the Democrat security structure are very, very anti-Russian. So the row that went on at the top level in the US was whether we're going to try and bring down the Chinese first or bring down the Russians first. And I think we're now going to see a shift to a less hostile confrontational attitude to China, but not much. We're talking, you know, degrees here rather than any big change of direction. And, you know, back to the same old, the Russians are the enemy on the other front.
Well, from the Russian point of view, it doesn't seem to make much difference. Martin, isn't the Biden administration actually starting to embrace China, embrace the authoritarianism and the surveillance and that sort of thing?
No, I think that in actual fact, the Chinese and the US ruling class is still on a collision course. I mean, there's actually loads of muscle flexing going on over Taiwan. There's all the business with Hong Kong. There's the stuff about that came up in our parliament this week in the last couple of weeks about not signing trade deals with countries which have been accused of genocide. And that's the whole Uyghur question and so on. I don't think we're getting to a situation of mutual cooperation between Russia, China and the US. We're way away from that. We're talking about marginal changes.
OK, the
fundamentals are still pretty hostile. Martin,
what about this guy, Antony Blinken, the new Secretary of State, taking over from Mike Pompeo? A sign, apparently, he's saying that the Iranians have got to comply with the nuclear deal before the United States does. Well, the United States really is they're being a little bit cheeky here, aren't they? They're saying, well, we pulled out before, but you've got to rein back and you've got to go right back into compliance before we'll start thinking about rejoining. The Iranians, of course, are saying, well, if the Americans want to rejoin the deal, then we can start going back to compliance, but we're not going to be complying with the Americans not in the deal. So it seems a bit of a stalemate there.
Yeah, and I think if anybody was thinking that because Biden was Obama's vice president, that he's just going to go back to where we were before, that's clearly not the case. And it looks like, for example, they're going to carry on recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which, of course, was opposed by the State Department and so on. So what Pompeo has done, he's gone round creating as many kind of controversies as possible. He's gone around, you know, tweaking the noses of the Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, you know, all the people that they don't like. And then they've allowed the Democrats to come in and say, well, what are you going to change here? And of course, if they do start to be more reasonable, if they do, for example, decide to go back into the START treaty, you're going to find the Pompeos saying this is terrible, this is a sellout, just shows that Biden's this and that and the other. So, you know, it's very difficult. I mean, as the Russians say about the Americans, they're not really agreement ready. So there's not that. But I think a previously existing agreement like the START, we can legitimately hope that common sense will prevail there.
Yeah, okay.
But on everything else, it's a hopeless task.
Who is this guy, Tony Blinken? He's in his late 50s during the Clinton administration. He was in the State Department and held senior positions in the National Security Council from 1994 to 2001. A senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is the globalist think tank, and he advocated also for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Anyway, he's back now.
Yeah, well, Biden voted to invade Iraq. So no change there then. I think, you know, the fundamentals of foreign policy in the US aren't decided by elections. There was hardly any discussion of foreign policy in the elections at all, apart from who's more anti-Chinese and anti-Russian. That was about the limit of it, because ultimately it's a one-party state, if you like, run by the military-industrial complex. And they are still wedded to the idea that Russia and China are enemies that are ultimately going to have to be taken down, and that Iran has got to be put in its place. And they haven't changed that attitude at all.
Okay, Britain, of course, I mean, always the most, we agree. Blinken has suddenly appeared on the scene again, and he's in this major role, you know, taking over from Pompeo. So it's interesting to look at some of the business interests he's got. He co-founded a company in 2017 called WestExec Advisors, which with a woman called Michelle Flumoy, and various others. And their clients include Google's Jigsaw, the Israeli artificial intelligence company Windward, and surveillance drone manufacturers Shield AI, which signed a $7.2 million contract with the Air Force subsequently, and also other Fortune 100 types. It says, according to Foreign Policy, the clientele includes the defense industry, private equity firms, and hedge funds. He received $1.2 million in compensation, in other words, fees from this WestExec Advisors. So by brokering deals between Silicon Valley firms, the Department of Defense, law enforcement, and the Israelis, he's making himself quite a lot of money. And he's been compared, this firm, to the firm set up by Henry Kissinger, Kissinger Associates, to do the same sort of thing, basically broker deals between government contractors and the private sector, people giving out government contracts, making sure that certain favoured private contractors always get these various Pentagon deals, Martin.
Yeah, and the other thing that they do is that they've for many years ensured that every congressional district has got some Pentagon investment in it, so that even on the most basic level, if you oppose Pentagon spending, then you're basically going to put some people out of work in your constituency. So the beast is extremely strong. Pompeo has got similar links, so there's no real difference between them on that front. What you're going to see is a change of style rather than substance. Pompeo likes going around. I mean, Pompeo openly came down out with it and said, we steal, we cheat, we lie. Who's going to stop us? Ha, ha, ha. You won't hear that stuff from Blinken. He will be saying we're in defending democracy here, and we're defending the American way of life. We want to reach out to all the poor people in the world and lift them up. But at the same time, it's the same old stuff.
Also, just looking at the Black Sea, because, of course, this is where the US sticks its warships when it wants to annoy Vladimir Putin. The US Navy has sent three warships into the Black Sea this week, and Russia has deployed its missile system. So the US Navy activity in the Black Sea declined in 2020. NATO says it's increasing this year, and it is under Blinken. So the US Navy has three warships now operating the Black Sea, a region where NATO is looking to increase its naval presence. The USS Porter, guided missile destroyer, entered on Thursday this week, joining two US ships already there, the USS Donald Cook, another guided missile destroyer, and an oiler, USNS Laramie. They also transited into the Black Sea last Sunday. So Russia noticed the US warships operating near its coast and deployed a mobile coastal defense anti-ship system in Crimea. The Russian military said it was tracking the USS Donald Cook as it entered the Black Sea. So finally winds up the article on antiwar.com saying Russia hawks and NATO are hoping the US keeps up the military activity in the Black Sea this year. According to Stars and Stripes, US Navy spent 82 days in the Black Sea, down to 19 days from the previous year. So obviously it's beginning to go up again, Martin. While the US and Russia have reached an agreement on extending New START, the vital nuclear treaty, the Biden administration is maintaining a hostile stance towards Moscow. So Is this saber rattling in the Black Sea, or is it just pure coincidence that we've had these two ships go in this week?
No, I think it's a fairly clear signal from Biden, not so much to the Russians. It's more to the military-industrial complex, because, as you know, the USS Donald Cook, which is a spy ship, had all of its electronics knocked out by the Russian EMP forces.
So, hang on, it's a guided missile destroyer, isn't it? So this is
it had all its electronics knocked out
It's not so much of a spy ship as it's basically loaded up with loads and loads and God knows how many cruise missiles, which can be fired off at quite a blinding rate.
As long as the electrics on the ship are functional.
Yeah, to attack either ships or land targets. That's the guided missile destroyer.
Yeah, but I mean, the Russians knocked out all of his electronics. People can look this up online. They knocked out all the. It appeared both in the Black Sea and the Baltic. Both times, the Russians just knocked out its electronics. Now, from a military point of view, if it came to a shooting war in the Black Sea, then those ships would all be sunk almost immediately. So the Russians aren't scared of these ships. As you can imagine, the Gulf itself and the South China Sea. These are all death traps if there is a shooting war. The people on the land with modern equipment will waste any ships that are that close to them. It's as simple as that. So what we're going through here is a kind of a grand old Duke of York scenario where they're marching their ships up to the top of the Black Sea and the Gulf and all the rest of it. But the modern, you know, they're not going to win by doing anything like that. So we can be confident of. The problem is it's deliberate coke trailing. It's deliberately trying to provoke the other side. And of course, if the other side were provoked and did respond, then they can do something.
Martin
shows where we'd end up.
Just before we get away from Russia completely, we've had all these demonstrations in Moscow about Navalny. Now, the Saker is saying this is the Saker, one word, .is. We've interviewed him on this show before, and he's a Florida-based, Russian-born, I think, former military advisor to the United Nations. And he's saying, dress rehearsal of Kala Revolution in Russia. The South Front anti-government protests under pretext of the detention of the notorious Russian opposition leader. Well, ex-opposition leader. He certainly call him that in the Western press. Anyway, Navalny took place in various cities across Russia. They were characterized by underwhelming attendance, claims of grandeur, and awkward attempts at spreading violence. Protesters immediately endorsed by the Washington establishment. Martin, what do you make of Navalny and these protests?
Well, I've been following this quite closely because when he was first arrested, I was interviewed on RT about what was happening. They haven't been in contact with me in recent weeks, but I have been following this closely. Navalny clearly is a provocateur. I'm coming back to his so-called poisoning, supposedly with Novichok, which was supposedly on a water bottle. And then apparently Bellingcat managed to trick the person who did it to saying that it was on his underpants. All of this is regarded in Russia as theatre. And Navalny does have some support. He's got about the same kind of support in Russia as somebody like Russell Brand might have over here. But he's never been elected to anything. And although the West are bigging him up as the big opposition leader.
Russell Brand is an opposition leader.
Yeah, but he's never been elected to anything. And when Ksenia Sobchak stood in the presidential election, she got less than 2% of the vote. And she's a close ally of Navalny's. There's going to be a parliamentary election, a Duma election in September in Russia. And of course, the timing of all of this fits very well with Biden coming to power in the US. So I think it's sending a message to the Russians that the Biden administration is going to be unremittingly hostile to the current setup in Russia. But of course, most Western media that reported this haven't reported that there is an upcoming parliamentary election. Allies of Navalny will no doubt stand. And I very much doubt whether they'll get anybody elected because they won't reach the 5% necessary. And who will do well? United Russia will win. They will probably get more than 50% of the vote. Even if they don't, they can form alliances with other parties. but they probably will. Who will come second? That will be the Communist Party. Who will come third? That will be the Liberal Democrat Party, which is not Liberal Democrat as in Tim Kent that we had on in the first hour. They're Zhirinovsky's party. They're extreme right-wing nationalists, much more hostile to the West than Putin. And Navalny's views on are actually quite right-wing. He doesn't like Chechens. He wants to kick immigrants out of Russia and so on. So he's no liberal.
I mean, basically, Martin, he's a has-been from the Yeltsin era, who was mega
into that's right.
privatization at the time, which was, of course,
that's one of the problems the West has got with people like Navalny in Russia. They're regarded as Yeltsinites, the kind of people that allowed the country to be completely ripped
and
off.
And, of course, and those people are despised by most Russians.
Well, they are, yeah. But there's a younger generation on their Facebook feeds who see him as some kind of hero, a bit like Russell Brand or somebody similar. Yeah. He appeals to, you know, a younger generation that didn't live through the Yeltsin era.
Well, okay.
So they don't really know what happened.
Talking about the real stuff in Russia anyway, rather than the Navalny and his, you know, fake demos, which are covered massively, of course, by the West, because that's what they want to see. They want to believe, they want us to believe that there's some
Can I just say it's also related to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is just about to be completed, although now it may well be not completed, which would be a win for the war party in Washington. And, you know, I'm pretty certain that the West has cooked this all up. So the whole thing about him being poisoned with Novichok is it's just logically impossible. I mean, Novichok is a weapon of war that kills thousands of people with very small quantities. It's not the sort of stuff you smear on underpants, which then leads to a situation where nobody actually dies. And he's been arrested because he went back. He'd broken his bail for a previous conviction for embezzlement. And if he'd come back to Russia a week earlier, he would still have been within his bail conditions and he wouldn't have been arrestable. But he waited until his bail conditions had been exceeded and then came back so that he would be arrested. So that's the sort of, you know, and if the Russians are wise, they will basically just let him go and ignore him. But of course, that's not always the way these things work.
Well, it's
they can be flat-footed, Martin, and just be silly about it.
Surely, this is just a pantomime being put out there for the benefit of the Western media, so that they can.
The obvious thing for the Russians to do is let him go. I mean, if I was them, I'd let him stand in the election and lose, and then that would be the end of it. But of course, there's a tendency because he is basically working with Western intelligence services, that's clear. The whole thing about finding the Novichok on the plastic bottle, that was the German military lab that came up with that. And you thought, how does a bottle with Novichok get taken to Germany without killing everybody touching the bottle? Don't ask these questions, because if you do, then you begin to realise that the whole thing's a fraud.
Okay, Martin, can we just talk about a little bit about the World Economic Forum? Because Putin delivered a speech there. It's the virtual World Economic Forum. This is ramping up from a much bigger one. I think it's going to be in June or July later in the year, which is being dubbed the Great Reset, with Prince Charles and Klaus Schwab being the two main leaders at the moment, it seems, to be pushing this Great Reset. But anyway, the World Economic Forum, particularly since July last year, when it went into partnership with the United Nations, and the United Nations really strapped for cash. But Putin is saying, well, look, you know, in a nutshell, his speech, he says that and I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, a very good transcript, and actually you can watch it. I imagine there may even be some YouTube subtitles on there. If you want to watch. But in a nutshell, what he's saying is this pandemic has caused all sorts of problems. Let's use it as an opportunity to normalise economic relations. And Klaus Schwab says, hear, hear.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't forget that Xi Jinping and Putin were, you know, it's a virtual discussion this year at Davos, isn't it? Obviously, they're not in Davos. The mayor of Davos is a social democrat, and they were complaining that they hadn't got they're going to lose jobs as a result of it not coming. But they have been invited into this discussion at the World Economic Forum, and they, you know, if they're going to be invited, and especially if all they've got to do is sit in front of a computer, then they're going to participate in it. And what you've got is everybody pretends that what we really want to do is everybody cooperate, solve the pandemic, end inequality, uplift everybody, and we're all going to pretend that that's what we're all after. But behind the scenes, we're still at daggers drawn. Everybody's secret services are still busily at work. People are still dying in Syria every day. You know, it's a lot. It's a talking shop, basically.
Don't mention Yemen.
Well, indeed, don't mention Yemen. And of course, countries which get carrying out genocide, like Saudi Arabia, maybe we shouldn't do any trading with them. And there was a cross-party support in Britain for not signing trade deals with countries engaged in genocide. And, of course, the Tories all meant China. But, of course, if you're going to do that, then maybe we shouldn't be doing deals with the United States of America and with Saudi Arabia.
Okay,
so you know, there's a big gap between rhetoric and reality.
Yeah. Okay, Martin, we're going to go have a look at the some of the key players at the World Economic Forum. Bill Gates is one, sort of half in the background, but he's always been going to these events. And he, of course, has given up his job supposedly, although he hasn't given up his shares in Microsoft. He's now dedicated full time to being an ambassador for vaccines around the world, where he's already managed to kill probably tens of thousands of people, and in the various vaccine programs that he's been behind in Africa, basically experimenting on Africans. And so not really the best person in the world to do it, unless he's covered up for, of course, by the Western mass media, and they don't dare criticize him like they don't dare criticize the war criminal Henry Kissinger either these days. So let's have a listen now to a former journalist, now a podcaster, Natalie Minnis, who I spoke to earlier this week. And here she is giving us a bit of a background and some more detail on who is Bill Gates and who are the Bill Gates Foundation, who are now the main funders of the World Health Organization, which doesn't come as too much of a surprise, really, because the World Health Organization is part of the United Nations. And Bill is very friendly with the World Economic Forum, who now have a partnership agreement with the United Nations. So what's slowly happening is these international institutions, which are there to guarantee the peace of the world and regulate and, in fact, form policy largely, are now being privatized. And Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab are part of that. So let's have a listen to Natalie Minnis now talking about Bill Gates and Bill Gates Foundation.
Gates Foundation seems to have their funding all over the place. Bill Gates is like a trigger. You sort of, you know, he's like Marmite. You love him or you hate him, and he still does have his fans who, if you say a word against him, they immediately leap on you and start saying conspiracy theorist. But it's not conspiracy to say that this man's foundation is either the first or the second biggest funder of the World Health Organization, and that is a fact. And it's a glaring fact. The World Health Organization is dictating our lives. It's dictating most people on the planet's lives. And yet this man is basically the biggest funder of it. And his financial clout. I've nothing against someone making a lot of money and doing well. It's not about being jealous or envious. But when these people are directing my life in a way that I don't think is healthy, then you have to do something about it. And apparently now it was just announced that he's the biggest holder of farmland in the United States. So he's buying up farmland and he's preparing to fire dust into the atmosphere. So how can this be allowed to happen? How can people sit back and just say that's okay? You know, blocking out the sun, that's the plan.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, is to slow down global warming.
Well, that's what they're telling us it's about. Honestly, the guy must be bonkers. I mean, maybe global warming's happening. Whether man is to blame is another question. 11,000 years ago, Scotland was covered in an ice sheet. So, you know, over the years, 11,000 years ago is a blink of an eye in world history. So climate does change. And I mean, it's a good thing. It's fine to say maybe we should stop pumping out carbon or try to keep our carbon low. But to start doing things like firing dust at the sun, what could possibly go wrong?
Natalie Minnis there. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong, Martin? What's he doing firing dust at the sun to try and block it out?
Well, it's a kind of techno solution for what may or may not be a problem. And as the contributor there said, it may be a laudable goal to reduce our carbon footprint, whether there's global warming or not. We were talking earlier about how computers use up so much energy. What we really need to do is create more energy efficiency, surely, and do the same amount of stuff by without using the same amount of inputs.
Yeah, but what about this whole business of buying up all this farmland? We did report, I think it was middle of last year, a great article by William Engdahl, where he's talking about, you know, is Bill Gates trying to become a monopoliser of the world's food supply, you know, taking a great interest in these big grain producers, financial interest, that is, taking over farmland and basically turning it all into industrial agriculture. He just wants to be sitting there with his hands on the levers, pushing them backwards and forwards. And these tractors, probably automatic ones, directed by, 5G rays or whatever, you know, somehow, basically trying. I mean, the idea of monopolizing the food supply for many, many people over the years, of course, this has been it's been a great power to starve a country out, is a great political thing to have. But the idea that this sort of power could be in the hands of an individual is pretty frightening.
Yeah, well, I mean, the US has been trying to dominate the world food system since the 1950s. And so it's not a new phenomenon. And of course, it's presented like the Green Revolution was presented in the 1960s as the real problem is we've got hunger in the world. People are starving. And what we need to do is increase production so that we've got enough food to feed everybody. Now, as we speak, there is more than enough food to feed everybody. Amartya Sen, the Indian economist, pointed this out many years ago. The reason why people starve, pretty straightforward. They haven't got access to that food because they haven't got the resources, particularly just basic cash to buy it, or they can't produce it themselves.
You're reminding me here of the Irish potato famine, because mm-hmm. there was plenty of food in Ireland at the time. It was just being shipped out at gunpoint. That's why people starved to death.
Yeah, but I mean, the food systems all over the world, if you actually look at Southeast Asia, South Korea, Taiwan, China now, Japan, the reason they were able to industrialize is because they stabilized peasant agriculture. Now, that wasn't the way it worked in Britain and the United States. Essentially, in Britain, people were driven off the land into factories. The land was monopolized by landowners, and cheap food was brought in from all over the world, sugar from the Caribbean, tea from India, etc. Now, what they're doing is they're saying that we're going to do this on a super scale with high tech herbicides and all the rest of it. And I think that's a real giveaway. If they were really concerned about hunger, then they would be supporting land reform in countries like Brazil. Because, of course, the countries which are successful in Southeast Asia, like South Korea and Taiwan, for example, carried out a comprehensive land reform. The reason they did that is because they were terrified of communist revolution. And of course, ultimately, what we need to see is people in the developing world having access to land so that they can grow their own food and for the local market. And then you gradually move people into high tech as a gradual process.
That land is also quite useful to have a home on that you don't have to pay rent every month, Martin, which is what they did, of course, in the Irish Land League and the Irish Land Reforms in the late 1800s, where people got these amazing cheap government loans, virtually no interest loans, in order to buy land that they were renting off the English factors, the English absentee landowners, yeah. And also build a really decent home where they've been living in a hovel. So that is a fairly simple thing to do, and that I totally agree with you on that. But look, we're going to be having a look at Klaus Schwab in a minute. Natalie is anyway. And the World Economic Forum, whereabouts are they taking us in this global Great Reset? But before we do that, let's have a quick look, as I always try and do, at Prince Charles, because he seems to be a real nefarious hand in all of this. And when it comes to environmental justice, I'm just looking at an article from the Daily Mail from a while ago, but it's environmental justice or eugenics, it says. Prince Charles says we must reduce the world population by 3/4. Now, that's a little bit rich coming from him. Maybe he should be the first to sacrifice himself, but I don't think for some reason he will be. Prince Charles warns that we will need 4 planets like Earth to survive as we just take and take, and urges companies to focus on the green recovery following the coronavirus. So this is interesting to have him coming out with this, Martin. And the parallel article to this says that actually we produce enough food to feed 10 billion people. So why does hunger still exist? So what do you make of this statement by Prince Charles that we actually need 4 planets like Earth in order to survive?
Well, it's basically old-fashioned eugenics being dressed up as some kind of concern for the planet and, to reduce and the reduction of inequality and so on. What's happened is that the rhetoric of the powerful has changed to being one of, empowerment and all the rest of it and all the various buzzwords. But the reality is that they want the natural resources in the developing world, but they don't necessarily want all of the people. And, capitalism has always functioned like this. Imperialism has always functioned like this. And, it's just a lot of hypocrisy, really. But at the same time, it sounds much. I mean, they don't come out. I mean, back in the day, the 18th century, they were quite blatant about it. We're going out there to rip them off, and we're entitled to rip them off because we're racially superior. Now it's all about helping them and bringing them up to our level, provided they do as we say.
And provided 3/4 of them disappear in a puff of blue smoke. Anyway, let's have a listen to Natalie Millis now on Klaus Schwab. And she's made the connection, as I did a while back, but she's looking also into these networks of power, private international fascist power, that behind a lot of this. So that's particularly the Bundesbank Club and the Bilderberg Group. So here's Natalie here talking particularly about Klaus Schwab and the related subjects to that. Ricky, looking a little bit deeper into who this guy really is.
Who elected these people? Why are they dictating our lives? How did they get to where they are? There was a film of Klaus Schwab and talking to the leader of the EU, the EU Commission, the head of the EU Commission, I think it's Ursula von Leyen. And apparently she was elected by 385 people. These people have enormous power. So Klaus Schwab, I think very few people had even heard of him until last autumn. And he suddenly was all over the place. He took centre stage. So I was curious as to who he was, and I looked him up on Wikipedia, and it said that he'd got a few degrees. He'd obviously done quite well academically. And then at the age of 33, he founded the European Management Forum, which eventually became the World Economic Forum. And it just presented it as, okay, he gets a few degrees and then he creates this economic forum that dominates the world, that's preparing to take over world leadership. How does that happen? And I just thought something is missing here. And I searched and searched, and it took me a while, but eventually I found this article published in Australia that said it was a sort of profile on him. It had been written a few years ago, and it said that he'd been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee, but it didn't give any sourcing for it. So again, I did more and more research, and eventually I found this page from bilderbergmeetings.org, and that's apparently the official Bilderberg website, and it said that yes, Klaus Schwab was on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, and strangely, that article had obviously been taken down because it was on archive.org. Someone had taken it and archived it. So I got the impression that this man's profile, someone had been kind of trying to tidy it up a little bit. And I looked further and eventually I found this really interesting academic paper published by the University of Freiburg by a man called Alexander Miloš Žilinský. And it's called The Bilderberg Conferences as Transnational Informal Governance Network, which is quite a mouthful. But it's really interesting. And he basically was saying that he calls it a transnational power elite. It sounds as if there's a kind of undercurrent of gangsterism going on. So you've got this massive power elite, which is trying to lead the world. A very small elite, but it's got massive power. But they seem to be hand in hand with some very dodgy elements to me. And in fact, this academic paper that was published at the University of Freiburg is really interesting because it shows what a sort of narrow cultural kind of elite this is. Very strongly Anglo-Saxon in character. And until recently, he says it was very male-dominated. And he said that the USA is followed by the UK as by far the most dominant participants in the Bilderberg group, then by France, with the Netherlands in sixth place. But the Netherlands obviously is significantly influential in the inner circle because of the Dutch royal family and Prince Bernhard. People often say that Boris Johnson looks as if he's like a puppet. And I feel that there's definitely something of that going on. These guys are compromised. They all come from that really close Eton Oxford elite. And when you look into the Billingdon Club, it was hosted by Nat Rothschild, who's the son of Jacob Rothschild, who goes to the Bilderberg conferences. And he's very close to Henry Kissinger. And he was the son of Victor Rothschild. So I'm not one of these people who thinks that anyone with the name of Rothschild is, sort of plotting to take over the world, because it's a huge, big family. But there's something about that particular family, that close-knit family, something going on there. There was also that incident with George Osborne on that yacht with Derry Pascha, and that was with Nat Rothschild as well. So it's as if these people are kind of power-broking to some extent, which would be fine. But then we've had two prime ministers who were in that close circle, and they have, you know, what's really going on here? How much of when people go to the polls? I actually stopped voting a few years ago because I just felt the whole system's totally corrupt.
So it's Natalie really finishing off with the killer point, really, Martin. She's saying that it looks like a kind of gangster is to just putting their own people in power. So what's the point in voting?
Well, I'll come to that. I mean, basically, what we're seeing is these are very well integrated elites, and as has been pointed out, most people had never even heard of Klaus Schwartz a couple of years ago, and you can be quite sure there are other people out there equally powerful who we haven't heard of. Yeah, so the elite is actually made up of people we have heard of: the Nat Rothschilds, the Klaus Schwab now. And other people behind the scenes that we haven't heard of, often based in intelligence agencies, for example, and who don't boast about who they are. So in a way, ruling classes have always functioned like this. So it's not really a new phenomenon, is it? And there was some Robert Michels in the 19th century talked about the iron law of oligarchy. Is that whenever people get together and organise things, certain people rise to the top, like cream or shit, whichever you prefer, and they then organise everybody else, and that's a process which has been going on for a long time. But of course, what we're now seeing is that the global capitalist system coming into the major crisis that it's been in since the 1930s. And so all of they've got their solution, which is to reboot capitalism on a different basis. They need various things to do that. And that's what this is all about. And the actual reality, which is that it's an unstable system and may just collapse into chaos or revolution. And of course, you know, voting doesn't, you know, is just part of the political process. Not voting doesn't change anything unless you've got another mechanism. And of course, what we saw in Ireland over many decades, recent decades, is people using armed struggle and voting. They didn't certainly rely just on voting.
No, okay.
That happens all over the world as well. Okay, and so struggles are still going on, despite all of this.
Natalie did a super job, really, in digging a little bit into who this guy is and where he came from. Klaus, Mr. Wonderful Schwab, a wannabe ruler of the world. And what about Scotland, though? Because obviously, as you can hear from there, she was talking to me. She's, I think, originally Glaswegian. Natalie, I thought I'd ask her about the Scottish National Party and what she makes of politics in Scotland these days.
I've come to think, I did vote for the SNP in the early 2000s. I used to be a kind of left-wing Labour voter, and then I went off them. That was mainly because of Gulf War and other things. And then I started voting for SNP. I thought I really liked what they were doing. But I think for many people, the SNP is like a religion. And I once got a letter. It was when I was a journalist on a trade magazine. I got a letter from one of them, and it was signed "Yours in Scotland." The way that some very fervent Christians would sign "Yours in Jesus." So I do think it's almost like a religion, and they know that if they get into power, it's their mission to try and get independence for Scotland. So I think that she's just carrying out her mission. I wouldn't really be. In theory, I'm still someone who I like the idea of independence for small countries. I don't like the Westminster system. I think the Scottish political system is a bit fairer since we've got devolution. But I think that what the SNP think is that if we got independence, it would be like a one-party state. They would be in power forever and ever. But that's not the case. They might. Labour was in power. Labour thought that they were going to be in power forever and ever. And look what happened to them. So I think people just need to just start, get away from party politics. That's what I think.
Well, that's Natalie leaving us with that little thought, that idea. There's been some big changes in Scotland, Martin, not least of which is the fact that there's now only one police force for the whole of Scotland. A lot of people have pointed to that as a massive centralisation of power. And we've seen ever since the Blair years this kind of regionalisation, and that's part of what the EU wanted to see, isn't it? The idea that, you know, Britain has got to be broken up into these various regions, you know, Scotland, Wales and England, and that we're now talked about as the three nations, or is it four nations with Northern Ireland, rather than Great Britain. This regionalisation is quite important, and Scotland obviously is asserting its independence as much as it can, with Nicola Sturgeon this week saying to Boris Johnson, what are you doing here up here in Scotland? You know, we don't really want you here, and anyway, your trip isn't necessary. Go back home.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were talking in the first hour about the local elections, and there's going to be elections to the Welsh Assembly and to the Scottish Parliament. And the SNP have said that if they win, which they look as if they will, because it's a proportional election, you see, and of course, over time, that changes the dynamic. They will bring forward a referendum bill, which they will then try and agree with London if they can. And if they won't agree, then they'll try and take it to court, and they may ultimately decide to just have a referendum on independence, as Lithuania did in the 1990s,
or
as Catalonia did.
Yeah. And then will they come a cropper? No, because the EU supports the Scottish.
Well, no, they will say. I mean, what Boris was saying when he was up there this week is that this was a once in a generation vote in 2014. But they were saying, but we were told that we were staying inside the EU. We've just voted to stay inside the EU by nearly 60%.
So Tony Blair didn't just
on a virtually no deal Brexit. So
Tony Blair didn't just start a war in the Middle East. He started this whole process of disintegration of Great Britain as well, didn't he?
Well, I think the process of disintegration of Great Britain began when Michael Collins came across to negotiate with Churchill and Lloyd George in 1920. And I'm afraid Britain has never been a united state like, for example, France. We are a multinational state like Yugoslavia. And, you know, the potential for it to break up has always been there. And don't forget, we've had a 30-year civil war in Ireland about exactly these issues. So nobody can say this has all been sprung on the map from nowhere. This has been going on for, as they say in Ireland, 800 years. And just because the English think that they've got the right to rule Ireland and apparently Iraq and apparently Afghanistan, that's not necessarily how everybody else in the rest of the world sees it.
OK, so we're going to go to a fairly long clip now, 7 minutes or so, from Dr. Vernon Coleman. Here he looks at what he calls the Agenda 21 scenario from the early 1990s up to 2021 and what it really means. Now, it's not because I'm endorsing this, and I'm sure you won't, Martin, but it's just an interesting take, I think, on what has been a very long-term plan, really over the last 30 years or so, to bring about this kind of what we're seeing now in 2021, which is effectively the Great Reset, a complete change in the way the world's economy works, from this kind of green agenda. But it's not necessarily an environmental green agenda. It's more of a political green agenda, which suits the rich and powerful. So let's have a listen to Dr. Vernon Coleman and his take on Agenda 21 now.
People have wanted to take over the world for centuries. You could probably trace the idea of a world government back to the Garden of Eden, if you had the time and the energy. But in practical terms, I think the evil plan for a global reset, a new normal, can really be traced back to 1909, when it was first suggested that it was far easier to control people if you have a good, long war going on. This was long before George Orwell, of course. We can then jump to 1932, when people at Columbia University had the idea of introducing energy as a new currency. They came up with the word technocracy and the idea that the world would be a much better place if it were run by scientists. The technocrats wanted to abolish private property and change education so that it merely prepared students for the work that had been selected for them by people who knew better. This nonsense gave Aldous Huxley the idea for his novel Brave New World. And then we jump to 1961, when a bunch of Kennedy administrator insiders, most of them Bilderbergers, unearthed the old idea of using war to keep the people under control. After much thought, however, they created a twist on that idea. They thought it would be a damn good wheeze to create massive worldwide pollution and then blame the citizens of the world for the mess and make them clear it up. If you're beginning to get the idea you know where this is going, you're right, you do. The next things that happened were the formation of the Club of Rome in 1968 and the formation of the World Economic Forum in 1971, though it wasn't called that then. The Club of Rome was formed by a mixture of United Nations administrators and rich businessmen, the World Economic Forum, who hold that silly beano in Davos every year. In 1976, there was another move towards what we now know as Agenda 21. The United Nations decided to take control of the world's land and to control the world's population. The plan, created by a bunch of unelected interfering bozos, was to put the rights of the community over the rights of the individual. This used to be called communism, but they dreamt up the name communitarianism, which is as much fun to spell as it is to say. Things moved quickly after that. In 1980, they invented the idea of sustainable development, two words that ought to strike terror into the hearts of anyone who cares about people, the world, integrity, respect, and the environment. And in 1983, they set up a commission to prepare us all for a new world order. For the best part of a decade, they were still all fumbling around like teenage boys at a dance. And then in 1991, the Club of Rome, which you'll remember if you've been paying attention, decided that they needed to find a new way to motivate and distract the masses. They dug around and, with a total lack of imagination, came up with global warming. Now, global warming had been toyed with as a threat since the 19th century, but every time anyone had suggested that the planet was getting hotter, it quickly became apparent that the idea was a load of rubbish, because it wasn't. The Club of Rome put a twist on this old bit of nonsense. They said it was all our fault because we'd caused the global warming, which in fact wasn't there any more than it had been in Queen Victoria's day. And then in 1992, the United Nations held a conference in Brazil, and Agenda 21 was born. This was the real start of communitarianism and the beginning of the end of individualism. Before you could say Tony Blair or Bill Clinton or even Al Gore in a DVD, which would get 3 out of 10 for accuracy, the world was set to change. Loads of big hitters came in at this point. Prince Charles, son of Queen Elizabeth, and famous mostly for having large ears and talking to plants, was one of those who saw this as a quick way to become terribly important and a world-class hypocrite. Charles spent most of the following decades flying around the world in private aeroplanes, telling people that they mustn't fly around the world in aeroplanes. It was clear that there was a ton of money to be made out of carbon trading, a completely nonsensical piece of chicanery which changed absolutely nothing except the size of the bank balances of the people running the carbon trading scam. They planned to dumb down education, close all small companies, empty rural areas, force people to live in tower blocks in smart cities, and shut down farms. Food would be grown in laboratories, which would, in due course, end up being owned by people like Bill Gates. It was also agreed that it was necessary to force the simple-minded citizens to learn how to take orders and to become compliant slaves. And so recycling was invented. It didn't matter that all the freshly washed yogurt cartons ended up being transported to countries thousands of miles away to be burnt or buried. The recycling wasn't the point. This was all about compliance. In America, the events of 9/11 enabled the US to create some wonderfully oppressive new laws, and bits and pieces of terrorism around the world helped other countries do the same. The threat of weapons of mass destruction enabled politicians to take away whatever privacy and freedom we had left, and diseases were used as threats too. AIDS and all those funny influenzas were such a threat that we all had to change our lives and accept orders from those who decided they were our betters. Regionalization was brought in as a first step towards globalization, and lovely, well-built 19th century houses were knocked down because they didn't fit into 21st century building regulations. The big, well-built old houses were replaced with crappy apartment buildings and tacky little houses made out of cardboard, which did satisfy the building regulations. Cars were targeted as being bad for the environment, and we were all told that we had to stop using fossil fuels and start living on sunshine and wind. Since neither of these provided enough electricity to give everyone a lit light bulb, governments started chopping down trees, chopping them up, calling the result biomass, and burning it. Anyone objecting to what was clearly the beginnings of a huge scam was dismissed as a conspiracy theorist and publicly shamed and demonizing. Rural living was made damn near impossible by letting roads go to ruin, by ruining water supplies, and by introducing wild animals into country areas. The banks decided they'd get rid of cash and replace it with a digital system. Billionaires worked out ways to change the temperature, control the weather, and force us to eat laboratory-made food. Psychologists were hired to brainwash us all. The police were pushed into demonizing themselves as well as us. ID cards and microchips were promoted as a really good thing, and there was much talk of the need to depopulate the world. And that all took us up to the start of 2020. But they still needed something else with which to control us. They needed something they could use to terrify us and force us to do as we were told. You can fill in the rest yourself. Thanks for watching An Old Man in a Chair, and thanks for all your support. Although it may feel like it at times, please remember that you're not alone. More and more people are waking up. If we're going to win this war, then we have to fight hard with passion and determination. Distrust the government, avoid mass media, and fight the lies. Thank you for watching An Old Man in a Chair.
Okay, that's Dr. Vernon Coleman there, the old man in the chair. Martin, you know, he's painting a picture of a conspiracy, particularly between 1992, the time of the Rio Earth Summit, as a kind of eco-fascist agenda, really. I mean, that's in a nutshell what he's saying there. I think I would, you know, really seriously draw a line under what he says about global warming. I do think global warming definitely is going on, and but you know, he's saying he doesn't think it is. I think it's quite clear that there is global warming. The question, of course, for people like me, is to what extent is this a human influence, or what other influences might there be? You know, in what can we do anything about it? We had Natalie earlier on pointing out about the, you know, Scotland 11,000 years ago being covered in ice, the whole of the country. So, I mean, there's obviously an attempt to control the narrative by shutting people like Vernon Coleman out, and to make sure that there isn't any kind of real criticism of this Agenda 21 agenda, which seems to be moving the world towards a kind of corporate World Economic Forum privatized policy unit, which is actually doing one of the most powerful things which any kind of international organization can do, and that is controlling the money system too. So anyway, what did you make of what you heard? Was complete and utter poppycock, or do you think there's any truth to what he's saying?
Well, I think what was missing for me from that is the discussion of the evolutions in the private financial markets, because from 1945 to 1973 we did have a degree of national sovereignty. In the United Kingdom, for example, you couldn't take money out of the country more than £1,000 without permission. And that wasn't just Britain, that was normal. And in actual fact, countries could, for example, invest in their own country without that money leaking out and the currency collapsing. And of course, what happened is that was all undermined, and that wasn't mentioned in anything he's talking about. So he's basically picking up on the, what you might call the political level of what the UN is saying. And he's not talking about, I didn't hear anything in there about Wall Street, about the International Monetary Fund, about structural adjustment in developing countries, about the fight for land in developing countries, where, you know, in the Nicaraguan Revolution in 1979, they kicked out Somoza after 50 years of brutal dictatorship, and they gave the peasants the land. But of course, he wants to see this technocratic elite, and there is a technocratic elite which is using a green rhetoric in order to try and consolidate its power. I totally agree with that, but underlying all of that is the old rapacious capitalism of the 19th century still being repeated in the 21st century, except with 21st century weapons.
Yeah, I mean,
the real danger isn't Prince Charles preaching hypocritically about greenery. It's the fact that in actual fact, the financial system is shot to pieces. We're probably going to have a war which will go nuclear, and then we really won't be worrying too much about global warming anymore.
Well, maybe, but I mean, Prince Charles is in a very good position, isn't he, right now? I mean, we heard from Tim Cohen a few weeks ago on this show, the author of The Antichrist and A Cup of Tea, about Prince Charles's key role at the Rio Earth Summit back in 1992, which was starting all this process off. So, you know, he's obviously had his eye on the main chance here for quite a while in doing something about the global financial system, whether that's going to be politically benefiting him or whether it's just being done because he's such a nice guy is anyone's guess. So we're going to have a listen now to, we mentioned Desmond Swain. So Desmond Swain, the Tory MP, in the first hour, Martin, but I thought we'd have actually listen to what he's got to say about what he thinks are the twisting of National Health Service figures, the distortion of statistics, and then also a little bit about, you know, the idea that the COVID virus is being spread in schools, and so we've got to close all our schools down. So it'd be interesting because you're working in a school at the moment, and it'd be interesting to see what you've got to say to him. But I find it rather irritating when people are criticising Desmond Swain without actually listening to what he said. So let's have a listen to him now talking on talk radio about school closures.
It's a disaster for children, and it's a disaster for families. I'm getting constantly emails from parents who are at the absolutely end of their tether. Remember, the position of the government is, and I think it's correct, schools are safe. Schools are not vectors of transmission. Schools have been closed purely because of the community activity that they generate, with children going to school in the morning and coming home from school in the afternoon, and the general activity that that creates, undermining the message, stay at home. Now, I think in terms, if that is the only contribution that schools are making to the nature of the problem, then the question of a cost-benefit analysis of the costs of children not going against to school as against this generation of community activity with them going to school strikes me as completely out of kilter.
Indeed. Well, the Public Health England has said primary schools were safe to return after half term in February, the last week of February. Only 3% of primary schools had any cases in the autumn term, and most of those were teachers. I mean, we don't know where they got it from. They may well have got it in the community, as other people will have got it in the community.
Yes, so that's Desmond Swain, Martin. What do you make of it? Has he got a bit of a cavalier attitude? I mean, you've got Julia Hartley Brewer there on Talk Radio pointing out that almost all the cases of the 3% that they were in schools were teaching staff. I mean, the kids seem to be being forced to suffer here because the adult, although it's only the adults that are really spreading or catching the virus.
Well, The best place to be, of course, is in New Zealand, where the schools are functioning, and that means that you've got to get the policies right in the first place, as we were saying earlier.
Yeah, Martin. Whenever you talk about New Zealand, I think we've got to remind listeners that the New Zealanders had what you might call a 3-month head start on us when it comes
to. But in China, everybody's in school, Tony. The schools are all open in China. They're all open in Taiwan. They're all open in Vietnam. The reason why we're having school closures is because we didn't get control of the virus the first, the second, or the third time. Now, that's why we're doing it. And, of course, the government was saying that schools were safe on the Monday at the beginning of term, and then on the Monday evening, they said that they weren't safe and everybody should go home.
So what do we have to do to get control of the virus then? Because it seems to me a virus is something you can't necessarily control.
Well, the countries which are the alternative sage, which never gets mentioned on here, they're the alternative sage that have been set up to criticise mainstream sage. They're saying that you've got to go for zero transmission as your policy, not just containing the virus, zero transmission. And in actual fact, the countries which have gone for zero transmission have ended up with zero transmission, and their schools are all functioning.
You're talking about.
I think that we're in a bad position,
Martin,
as the Irish say, I wouldn't start from here.
Martin, you're talking about turning Britain into a gulag, but for how long?
As long as necessary, until you've got control of the virus. And if you lock down early and long enough to begin with, you can then come out. What was Eat Out to Help Out all about? Now, if you're going to open schools, and I think that has to be a priority, schools have got to be the priority, then the pubs and the churches and everything else will have to be shut, and the children will go to school, and everything else will be locked down. And, of course, you'll have to lock off the care homes as well. Nobody should be going in there.
Well,
if you're going to pursue that kind of policy.
Yeah, but okay.
Economic interests, like Tim Martin, who runs the pubs, want the schools to be functioning because they want the childcare that the schools provide so that the factories can
Martin,
work. There's been no prosecution
Martin,
of a single private business for Martin, breaking COVID regulations, even though 8,000 have been found in breach of regulations.
Maybe that's because the law isn't actually there to do it.
No, the law is there. It's just not being used. Individuals have been punished for going to parties and so on. Businesses, the whole idea that you can trade off the economy against infection is simply wrong. You've got to go for zero transmission, and then your economy can bounce back, as the Chinese are proving in spades.
What about trading off civil liberties for a load of duff statistics? But anyway,
civil liberties, your right to throw your fist stops where my chin begins, as John Stuart Mill famously said.
That's not what we're
talking
about.
I'm not going to be infected by you because you don't obey the rules.
Martin, we're not talking about the right to punch people in the face. Liam Halligan here is talking about the NHS statistics, and he's on the Planet Normal podcast. And here is a few questions that he raises about those statistics now.
I'm now looking at the Public Health England all-cause mortality surveillance bulletin, because that's the kind of guy I am. The week 53 report, up to week 52 data, and it says, and I quote, in week 52, 2020, there was no statistically significant excess all-cause mortality by week of death in either England or Wales. That is compared to the same week in 2019. And if you look at the graph that accompanies this bulletin, you do see a sharp peak in deaths in April. Mm. Of course, COVID is bad. It stripped out a lot of more vulnerable members of our population before their time in many cases, tragically. And we're right to respond to that. We did a lockdown and that was the right thing. But if you look at this winter spike in deaths now, it's roughly the same as 2018 and 2019, and it's lower than 2016 and 2017. And that is what the official data shows. Again, a rider, because we're responsible people. This data should be interpreted with caution, Public Health England says, of this very latest data, due to delays in reporting over the Christmas period. Mm. So we will see. But on the current evidence, death rates this winter are similar to 2018 and 2019. That is what the data shows. Have you heard that on the television news? No.
Well, the answer, your answer, of course, is because it's the wrong story. They don't like anything that doesn't increase the fear. Martin, one of the reasons we may have no extra actual mortality might simply be because the people are being wrongly ascribed to have died of COVID-19 when they haven't actually died of COVID-19 at all. We know the PCR tests deliver between 5 and 10% false positives. And even the World Health Organization, as we mentioned last week, are saying you shouldn't be using this PCR test. And if someone tests positive on the PCR with no symptoms, that's no good. You have to test them again on a more detailed test for them to actually be positive. And yet that's what we're doing right across the country. I mean, there is certainly, you know, obviously there are people dying with COVID, but it looks certainly from the statistics and from what Liam Halligan is saying there, that they're juicing this up with lots of people who are not dying of COVID being put down as COVID deaths.
Well, one of the things they discovered in Australia, and of course they've had a relatively good COVID war as well, is because of the lockdowns, people didn't get the usual flus they got. So they didn't die of the flu that they were going to die of, that might have died of otherwise. I'm not going to get it. I've been reading lots about the statistics, but I haven't got it up in front of me on the computer, Tony, and I'm not really prepared to go into an argument about it. I'm willing to accept the general view that there is, and that's what you're hearing from the front line in hospitals, that lots of people are dying rather horribly of COVID, because, of course, you basically can't breathe and you gradually drown in your own mucus in your lungs. So it's not just like having a heart attack. I think if you're going to push the line that the stats are all wrong, you can try and push it, but there's an awful lot of pushback going to come on that from lots of people who are saying, no, we don't agree with that. And it's all very well people saying Liam Halligan is an economist, or rather he's a journalist and was an economist. He's not got no epidemiological
He's just reading out the data skills, there, you know? Martin. He's quite entitled to read the data out from Public Health England. Well,
yes, he is, and I'm entitled to listen to other people who are saying we've got a second wave crashing through our hospitals, and I'm also very convinced by the economic arguments for going for zero transmission.
I mean, are you convinced, though, by this argument that says that every January since 2012, our intensive care units in our hospitals have been in crisis? For example, in Gloucestershire, where and of course they've shut the accident and emergency at Weston, they've shut the accident and emergency at Cheltenham Hospital too. So the accident and emergencies and the hospitals generally are even more under pressure than they would have been normally in January 2020, 2019, or the rest of them, all the way back to when the Conservatives came into power and started to destroy the NHS under Andrew Lansley.
Well, I certainly do accept that when the NHS was run not with the trust system and the internal market, that you build in lots of redundancy into the system. So you've got lots of empty beds just in case something like a pandemic comes along. And of course, once the bean counters got in charge of it, they tried to run it like a factory, so that you try and make sure you've just got exactly the number of beds you need and no more. And then, of course, something comes along and you can't cope with it because you're not prepared to cope with it. So that's all legitimate. But I think
the other thing we've done, of course, is we've closed over the last 30, 40, even 50 years, closed all the isolation hospitals that were out there. And there were scores of them across the country, which would have been perfect places to put people who tested positive. We wouldn't have needed the Nightingale hospitals, which we didn't have the staff for anyway. There are many, many people who simply will not go and work in hospitals because they're afraid of catching COVID-19, who are qualified to do so. There's also a whole tranche of staff who are being told to self-isolate at home because they've had a positive test, even though they don't have any symptoms. So it's the perfect storm. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Sir Desmond Swain himself speaking to Sky, talking about why he's been questioning some of these NHS statistics. So here's Sir Desmond Swain on the NHS statistics on Sky now.
All these statistics can be presented in a number of ways. And seen in the round, the reality is that we've had 4 years in the last five that make up the five-year average of relatively benign performance, certainly with flu being suppressed. And therefore, being within 15% of the five-year average is not untypical if you look over the last decade or so. You will see that years up and down to very significant extents.
Well, I suppose all he's saying there, Martin, is that the years go up and down, and it just happens to have gone up in 2020, which doesn't seem to be a very good argument to me. But anyway, let's have a listen now to there's a discussion about this all on talk radio yesterday evening on the James Whale programme. And I just think it'd be quite interesting to hear what was said about that, what he's been saying, because a chap called Joe Mulhall called in, and he's from a group called Hope Not Hate. I don't know if you can tell us anything about that group, Martin.
They see themselves as anti-fascists, and that they're going to call out people who are, racists of one kind and another. And, they get funding from the usual liberal sources. And, that's how they see themselves.
Yeah, but I mean, they've also been very active, haven't they, in the Labour Party, calling out anti-Semitism.
Yep. So, in other words, one has to take some of what they say with a pinch of salt, because a lot of accusations of anti-Semitism are really accusations against people who are hostile to the fascist policies, to put no finer point on it, of the state of Israel.
All right, well, let's have a listen now to, that's certainly my take on this chap, Joe Mulhall. I'm not sure how the founders of Hope Not Hate would take this sort of intervention, but here he is talking to James Whale on talk radio last night, and a guy called Ash, who co-hosts the programme with him, about Desmond Swain, but also criticising the Richie Allen show, which I love and listen to quite a lot. Richie is a professional journalist that used to work on Talk Radio Europe down in Marbella, and Matt found himself out on his ear after that. But he is up in Manchester right now, and he does a pretty much daily programme. I think it's just on a Saturday. He doesn't do any programme on the weekend, and he even does a Friday afternoon show, which I think is well worth listening to. He has some fantastic guests of all sides. In fact, he had Edwina Curry on there the other day. I think it was on Tuesday, and he was discussing masks with her, and she just hung up on him. She'd had enough. But he has all sides on, and Richie is definitely a professional. And here is this chap called Joe Mulhall from Hope Not Hate doing what is an appalling hatchet job, smearing Richie Allen. And it's interesting, if you have a listen, that he doesn't actually accuse Desmond Swain of being anti-Semitic, because Desmond Swain has got the Conservative Party behind him. He's also got plenty of money, and he would sue Joe Mulhall, and he would sue Hope Not Hate for that. What he does is he picks on Richie Allen, the journalist, because he knows that Richie hasn't got much money, and he couldn't take him to court, and he couldn't sue him. So a bit of a sneaky move here. But anyway, have a listen to this now. James Whale and Ash on talk radio last night, and the guest is Joe Mulhall from Hope Not Hate, who phones in.
Sir Desmond Swain.
Yeah, he's not had a great few days, has he?
He doesn't deserve to.
No, I mean, it's actually quite serious. I mean, yesterday it emerged, of course, that he'd been talking to anti-lockdown groups and kind of encouraging them to carry on. But things have actually got a lot worse today. We were looking into him at Hope Not Hate and actually found that back in November, he went on a really extreme anti-Semitic internet show called The Richie Allen Show. And this is a show that is really, really infamous for anyone that looks at the far right, and especially at Holocaust deniers. Some of the world's most famous Holocaust deniers go on this show. And so the first feeling was absolute shock that a conservative MP would be anywhere near a conspiracy theorist show like this that's kind of synonymous with Holocaust denial and anti-Semitism.
I mean, I presume, I've not heard of it, but I presume then that's something in America.
No, actually, Richie Allen's based in the UK.
Is he? So, Have you heard of him, Ash?
I've heard of him, yeah.
I haven't even heard of him.
Yeah. He's got a radio show and he's based in the North. He's kind of the protege of David Icke, you may have heard of.
Well, yeah. Hang on. So he's anti-Semitic, and he has his own radio show. Well, that it must be some online obscure thing, then.
Yeah, the Richie Allen Show is based online. And
I don't think we should give him quite this much publicity, you know. I think, Doctor, you probably shouldn't really mention his name again.
Fair enough. I'm happy to do that. I mean,
because I don't think giving these morons publicity is a good idea.
Well, should he have the whip removed? I mean, what should happen to him?
Oh, I'm talking about the Desmond Swain. Right, okay,
yeah.
We should have everything removed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's clearly crossed the line, not just in terms of the stuff he was saying yesterday, or the stuff that he's been quoted as saying that link into the kind of anti-lockdown stuff, which is really, really dangerous. But it also just shows a huge lack of awareness and kind of professionalism to end up on a show that is, you know, the other guests on the show that he was on were Holocaust deniers, you know, and for a Tory MP to be anywhere near this is outrageous. There has to be a line, and politicians of all stripes need to take a stand against this sort of hatred. And it's
but
just
did he attack the Holocaust deniers? Did he say they were talking rubbish?
No, he wasn't. This was like he was a guest on the show. There was two guests on the show. They spoke to him, and they spoke to someone else. Yeah, but I mean,
so he wasn't. Hang on a minute. So he wasn't actually talking about the Holocaust.
No. He was talking about lockdown. So in his section, he was talking.
Oh, so what you're saying is the host of this show, as far as you're concerned, is a Holocaust denier.
So, yes, this is this chap, Joe Mulhall from Hope Not Hate, tying. I felt a bit sorry, really, for James Whale there, who's obviously not heard of the Richie Allen Show, doesn't know anything about him, thought initially that it was based in the United States. But Martin, this is a particularly appalling bit of smear tactics. And it was lovely to hear one of Richie's listeners. And I think probably the producer of the program had realized that this is potentially actionable, what this guy, Joe Mulhall from Hope Not Hate, was saying there, accusing Richie Allen of being a Holocaust denier, of being anti-Semitic. And those are the two things which, I mean, literally, you know, that would be straight into court if anybody with money was to be accused of those things. So anyway, what do you make of what you've just heard there? Because it seems as if they're trying to lump him all together with Desmond Swain as a Holocaust denier because he's on this program with Richie Allen, who's a Holocaust denier. Of course, Richie is not a Holocaust denier. That is a total lie. He's not. Neither is he anti-Semitic. It's another absolute lie that Hope Not Hate spokesperson Joe Mulhall is telling there. And it was lovely to hear someone from Richie Allen's show phone up a bit later on that program to say, well, this is just not true what this guy was saying, and that he was spinning you a line there. Anyway, what do you make of that sort of call, Martin? Because it's quite important, isn't it, that. That we get these facts straight, that if the idea of Richie Allen is the idea that Richie Allen is doing this kind of stuff, it seems as if someone somewhere is afraid of what he's up to.
Yeah, well, I think, the spokesperson for Hope Not Hate there is, you know, basically attacking, you know, if he'd stuck to attacking Desmond Swain for arguing about the stats and being anti-lockdown. I mean, Desmond Swain openly is anti-lockdown. I'm not. It's not. I don't agree with that. I think it's potentially dangerous and all the rest of it. But why bring all this other stuff about anti-Semitism into it? I suppose Hope Not Hate are an anti-fascist group, so they feel that they've got to bring this up. But, I mean, as I understand it, what happened was Desmond Swain was on the Richie Allen Show, as others are, arguing about lockdown, as we are doing this evening. And then another part of the show had someone well known to both of us, Tony, Nick Corlstrom, talking about the Holocaust. And of course, we have had to distance ourselves from his views on the Holocaust.
You could argue,
well, it's a discussion show, so we'll have somebody on to talk about this. But you know, the problem with that is you then get, if you allow them on to talk about it, then you're basically accused of encouraging such views. And of course, then there's all this question of guilt by association and so on and so forth.
I mean, even if you're tearing the person apart for saying it, you know, apparently that's you're still supporting them. But I mean, Kolostrom is particularly interesting in that he keeps his views on the Holocaust extremely secret. And in fact, he even lies about them. He lied about them to me saying that basically he thought things that we later found out he didn't think. So he was being quite sneaky in getting in there. So it's almost like he's kind of deliberately attaching himself to some certain people in order to make it easier for people like Hope Not Hate to smear them. So I don't know. Anyway, I think it's quite up to Richie whether he wants to have somebody like that on there. But I'm sure he doesn't just go along with everything he says. Absolutely not. He's not like that. He's a very good journalist. Anyway, let's just go on also to look finally at the Stop Hinckley, because I also spoke this week, getting away from speaking about this whole business of Richie Allen and Holocaust Denial. By the way, you can find Richie Allen on almost every early evening at richieallen.co.uk, and it's well worth a listen. I would certainly thoroughly recommend it, and I have no bones about doing that. And I wonder, Because the talk radio people, one of the guys is saying, oh, yes, I've heard about this guy. I don't know very much about him. Actually, Richie is becoming almost unmissable because of what he does is what actually good journalists used to do, which is talk to all sides and do a thoroughly good job in absolutely unravelling everything to do with whatever is going on in the world today, particularly at the moment with the pandemic and the lockdown. A whole variety of guests of all different stripes listening, and you won't hear that kind of thing, I'm afraid, anymore on the so-called professional broadcasters. But anyway, we'll wind up this evening by having a listen to a chap called Roy Pumphrey, Martin, who is part of Stop Hinckley. And I think this is quite nice to bring things back home a little bit, because there's this enormous great big project going on down near Bridgewater, near us, just down in Somerset, which is to build this massive nuclear power station, which is going to produce electricity at an incredibly enormous price, far, far greater than the market would ever allow. And the whole business is being done in order to try and prop up a dying nuclear industry, which in many parts of the world has been put out of its misery, for example, in Germany. And yet this thing is still going on. Now, this week, they're so far away from actually reaching their deadlines, and they've obviously got that all wrong. They told the government it was all going to be ready, and of course it's not going to be ready. So they've announced this week they've got to hire an extra 3,000 staff down there in order to try and get it all finished on time. And then they also announced at the same time that it won't be finished on time. So they're behind schedule. Maybe it'll someday be there, but it will be a white elephant, because I would be surprised if anyone ever switches it on, because the electricity it was going to produce is going to be way too expensive for people to afford. So let's have a listen to Roy Pumphrey now from Stop Hinckley. And along with Natalie Minnis, I'll put the full interviews with Natalie and Roy up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. But here is an extract, a clip from the interview with Roy Pumphrey about what's happening down at Hinckley Nuclear Power Station, which is under construction, Hinckley C, right now.
They've put back their earliest estimate of a completion date. This is a last desperate throw of the dice to throw a lot more people at the job in the hope they can make up the time they'd lost for all the reasons they've put forward why they are so far behind schedule.
Okay, so they're looking to go from around about 5,500 up to 8,500 workers. That's another 50% extra. It's half as many workers down there again.
They've been, as ever, over-optimistic about how quickly they could get things done and underestimated the complexity of what they're trying to do. Because all of these things are a guinea pig. There is no template. This is not like cars rolling off a production line. For all that they say about this being a similar design to elsewhere, when it comes to building one of these things, they are so complex that the problems that are thrown up on any particular site are particular to that site. And that's what they're finding at Hinkley Point. It's being built two-thirds by the French government and one-third by the Chinese government.
And that means, I think, doesn't it, that these sorts of reactors are being used elsewhere in Europe, in France and Finland, and also already up and running in China. So at least we know that this is going to work once they switch it on.
Well, no, we don't, because whilst the ones in China are supposed to work, there's very little external observation about what goes on in China. What we know for a fact is that they haven't been able to get it to work in Finland or France.
Oh, dear. Well, look, hang on. So, but they have got it working in China. I suppose they would say that, well, this is, confidential. China is, authoritarian state, and we're not going to let you just come and wander around our reactors and see if it's going OK.
Well, that's what they are. They have got Chinese workers here at the moment, and one can only anticipate they will have to get some more in if they're the people that have been able to get one to work. Slowly putting the rings by which they construct the pressure vessel. They're starting to stack those up, but they're still 6 years away from getting anything complete. And even when it's built, they've still got to make it work. There was a nuclear power station in Bulgaria that sat there for 25 years complete, but never generated a single kilowatt hour of electricity. 25 years, and then they just took it apart. The government's get out over Hinkley is to say that whenever EDF announce cost overruns and delays, that's not a problem for us, because we're not funding the build. Okay, we're just paying for electricity if and when it ever delivers any electricity. So to that extent, why should we worry about EDF's problems with building it? Because it's no skin off our nose. But all that time, the cost of electricity is increasing with the index linkage that's attached to the generous price that was set. Well, where are we now? 6 or 7 years ago. And inflation can only go on adding to that. Sizewell C is a different matter, because the government realised it had been stitched up over the price of electricity deal for Hinkley C. So it was determined not to fall into that elephant trap again. So it's looked at something called regulated asset base, which is all about, it's used for things like giant new sewer systems and things like that. Fairly straightforward bits of infrastructure where you pay a small amount extra on your sewage bill, and before long, they construct the thing, and that surcharge is gone because it's built, it's up and running, and it's usually beneficial to have got something new, improved, and working. But nuclear power isn't like that, because all nuclear power does is run for a while, and then when it's finished, you've got the problem of what to do with the radioactive waste. And that's another aspect that still isn't sorted, because the radioactive waste from Hinkley C, if we ever get that far, and from Sizewell, which is an even more remote possibility, is much more radioactive than what we've had to deal with up till now. It will have to sit on the site for 60 years before it can be moved anywhere. And then the big question is, where will it all go? Because no one knows. We were told we would have some plan for a storage site for nuclear waste before any new power stations were built. Well, the government broke that. That was a promise made 10 years ago, and that promise has simply been broken.
What about Hinkley A and B? What kind of power stations are they? Are they still operating? And are they going to have to go into mothballs?
Hinkley A is been closed down for, we must be looking at 20 years. So the cost of decommissioning that one, we've had to bear that. How much are we talking about? £3 billion a year goes to paying for decommissioning defunct nuclear facilities, many of which are power stations. And Hinkley B is tottering on its very last legs before it gets closed down either this year or next. It's off at the moment, and it may never restart, because It's got problems with the graphite blocks, which are part of it. There are blocks of graphite which are part of the safety mechanism. They need that if they need to close it down rapidly, and that's now cracking. So they're having to close. It's way past its sell-by date anyway, but it will definitely close next year, if not this year. And then all we'll have to do is pay for the decommissioning.
That is Roy Pumphrey, or was Roy Pumphrey, from Stop Hinkley. Martin, this whole thing, I just cannot get away from the idea that it does look like a white elephant to me. If it's going to make electricity, which is so expensive that people won't be able to afford it. And also, you know, we heard, didn't we, from Dr. Chris Busby about 6 or 8 months ago, his thoughts on it. Well, this is just a scheme to pump the governments and investors for loads of money. And then once at some point, the contractors are all going to pull out and collapse their companies and run off with the loot.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that was a fairly good summary of the situation that we heard there. I understood that what that made it viable, A, is that you basically leave the waste is going to be dealt with by the public sector. You know, we're going to deal with the waste. Not that anybody knows what to do with the waste. And of course, once you factor that in, it really becomes uneconomic. And the only reason it's gone ahead in the first place is because they're guaranteed a price on the electricity, which may be way above the market price of electricity when it comes on stream. But of course, it may never come on stream for all the reasons that have been suggested. So, yeah, total waste of money.
Anyway, I said that was a final item. I thought maybe we'll finish with something which is a reminder of the mayhem last March as the various governments in the Western world were trying to struggle with all of this. And one of the clips I came across, which was the press conference with Trump, Pompeo and the US Fauci and the US Coronavirus Task Force, they called it, back on the 20th of March 2020, where Pompeo talks about it as a live exercise. And I kind of had to run this past myself twice. Is this really what he's saying, that it is a live exercise? Because you and I know, Martin, don't we, that, you know, for example, the 9/11 attacks, the 7/7 attacks, that these things had been being exercised at the same time. There were exercises running in parallel. And by talking about it as a live exercise, what Pompeo is hinting at here is that there was some kind of exercise running at the same time. And we know, don't we, that there was the Event 201 event just going on just before all this happened. So is it possible that that there was some sort of parallel exercise going on when the COVID outbreak began?
Well, I think the $64,000 question is this an accidental outbreak, or has it been planned in advance? And of course, if it's been planned in advance and it is a biological weapon, which I suspect it may be, then of course you've got to have lockdowns, which of course the Chinese intelligence services have worked out and carried through.
So let's have a listen now to Mike Pompeo, who then was US Secretary of State under Trump on the 20th of March 2020. So we were talking about 10 months or so ago, right as this coronavirus thing was just hitting everybody and the US was deciding to lock things down, Britain was too, where he talks about the whole thing being a live exercise. So what I've done is I've made sure that there's all the context of why he might say that rather than just him saying it's a live exercise. And you know, you can hear Donald Trump maybe in the background saying they should have told us, which is talking about China having not really spread the information as they should have done around the rest of the world, which is perfectly true, as we've seen that the Chinese did try and keep a lid on this whole thing, as authoritarian regimes often do, where journalists, well, I mean, having met Chinese journalists themselves, I wouldn't call them journalists at all. And it seems that most of our mainstream journalists in the West are going the same way. They just say what they're told to say. They don't ask questions, that sort of thing. So let's have a listen now to Mike Pompeo on the 20th of March 2020. It's part of his press conference at the Coronavirus Task Force in Washington, saying this is a live exercise.
This is Secretary Pompeo. News hours learned that the CDC picked up that there was some sort of virus happening in Wuhan, the coronavirus happening in Wuhan as early as December. When did the CDC start letting other agencies know that there was something in China happening, that this coronavirus was happening? And then when did the whole government approach start to happen?
So I'll let the CDC or Dr. Fauci, you want to talk to that? Yeah, Secretary Azar, please.
So we were alerted by some discussions that Dr. Redfield, the director of the CDC, had with Chinese colleagues on January 3rd. It's since been known that there may have been cases in December, not that we were alerted in December.
And then, Mr. President, the other question I have for you.
Excuse me, we'll do it in a second. May I just say
one more thing? There's been some discussion about China and what they knew and when they knew it, and I've been very critical. We need to know immediately. The world is entitled to know. The Chinese government was the first to know of this risk to the world, and that puts a special obligation to make sure that data gets to our scientists, our professionals. This is not about retribution. This matters going forward. We're in a live exercise here to get this right. We need to make sure that even today, the data sets that are available to every country, including data sets that are available to the Chinese Communist Party, are made available to the whole world. It's an imperative to keep people safe. We talk about the absence of data sets, not being able to make judgments about what to do. This is absolutely critical. This transparency, this real-time information sharing, isn't about political games or retribution. It's about keeping people safe. And so when you see a delay in information flowing from the Chinese Communist Party to the technical people who we wanted to get into China immediately to assist in this, every moment of delay connected to being able to identify this risk vector, the risk vectors, creates risk to people all around the world. And so this is why it's not about blaming someone for this. This is about moving forward to make sure that we continue to have the information we need to do our jobs.
So that's Secretary of State at the time, Mike Pompeo in the US there, Martin. What do you make of what he was saying? He's saying we don't really want to play a blame game because this was at the early stages of this. And, you know, since then, of course, they have been certainly calling it the China virus. They've been very much blaming the Chinese for this and the Wuhan lab.
Yeah, well, the Times of Israel, as you know, published, they said that the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States that a pandemic was coming out of China in November 2019. And also, of course, the stock market collapsed in terms of the credit crunch in September 2019. So I think the Chinese were playing their cards close to their chest because they didn't know what was happening, and it may well have been an attack on them, a biological warfare attack. It may just have been an accident. And, of course, then it's just a test between which system responds most effectively. But it could very well, and don't forget Pompeo was saying, we've had enough of China. We've had enough of the Chinese Communist Party. We're going to overthrow their system. And, of course, when the virus appeared in Wuhan,
Martin, what he actually says, we're not going to tolerate China.
Yeah. And the Chinese, you know, they flagged up that we are going to take down your system. And, of course, you know, the Chinese are very well aware that they are regarded as a major threat and that somebody is going to do something about them.
OK, so what about this comment?
Nuclear warfare is not possible because they've got nuclear weapons, but biological warfare certainly is.
I mean, what about this comment?
If it was, they're winning.
What about this comment, this is a live exercise? It's an interesting way to put it, isn't it?
It is. It is a very interesting way, and it may be Freudian, but we couldn't read too much into it. Yeah, but as you say, later on, they were quite happy to spread the blame around, although I think I sent you stuff about how the Wuhan laboratory might have actually been the source. But even if the Wuhan laboratory was the source, the West had people on the ground inside the laboratory. So that would have been a perfect opportunity for them to basically seed it inside the China just before Chinese New Year, which is why the Chinese at the minute are trying to repress the virus in Hubei province, because, you know, very soon everybody's going to be travelling like we do at Christmas. Everybody's going to be travelling around the country and it'll go all over the place.
That's right.
Get on top of
it. Yeah, the article you sent me is, if COVID-19 did start with a lab leak, Would we ever know? The two major investigations into the origins of the pandemic, this is in Wired.com, are compromised by potential conflicts of interest. Those problems need to be fixed and fast, because, of course, we all know that the World Health Organization has sent its team into Wuhan, Martin, although I wonder if maybe we probably find out more by just simply reading Whitney Webb than by anything that they're going to find out.
Yeah, well, it could be that this is a naturally occurring virus. It could be that it's been modified in a laboratory and escaped by accident, which is pretty much what those two articles are suggesting. Or it could be that it's a deliberate attack on the Chinese economy, given that that's what the Pompeo himself was saying. We're not going to tolerate China anymore. And all of the banging of the drums, we're going to put these people in their place. But if it was, the Chinese have actually managed to come through it fairly rapidly.
I mean,
and as long as they control this latest outbreak, their economy and Taiwan are going to be the only economies which will show positive growth in 2020. And of course, the Western powers are quite happy to have their own economies trashed as an excuse to bail the banks out. If there had been no COVID, we'd all have been discussing for the last year, what the hell have the banks been up to? We're bailing them out again.
It could also be that
the banks have been bailed out because of COVID.
It could also be, of course, a gigantic chess move by the globalists in order to justify taking over the United Nations and the global economy, effectively taking over the world.
Yeah, that's right. But the problem is with all of that, Tony, is that the effective lockdown in China means that China has not been defeated. And they were presuming, if it was an attack, that the Chinese would take the worst of the hit and then they'd be able to move in there. But they're not going to be able to do that, are they?
Well, we shall see. Okay, Martin, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That is Tim Kent. He's the Lib Dem councillor in Bristol City Council for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park. Also, thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist you just heard, Martin Summers, there, and studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bozanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You can even have a look at the three books that I've done. You can download free watermark copies of those, or else you can even buy them if you're feeling particularly generous at thisweek.org.uk on the Martin Bormann timeline tag, or else you can go straight to bilderberg.org, where you'll find all the links to the books there. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and all our contact details, etc., at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable PRSC weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. And you can listen on this stream at 5 and 11 most hours during the week to the same show if you missed it. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. It's going to be a fun